You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the mysteries. The very highest degrees of which combined together make up a secret order known as the Illuminati. Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system. Now, do you think they're succeeding?
Yes.
Haven't I described to you just now exactly what is going on in the world today? Yes, they're succeeding. They're succeeding because the American people don't understand their enemy. They don't even know what's happening. You don't really understand sometimes what a terrible burden it is to know some of the things that I know and try to wake people up and impart this knowledge to them and find out that they just have walls built in front of them. They want to be slaves. But we're making some chinks in those walls.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Joining us on the line live from Hong Kong, it's Robert Hanson. In the second part, a frontline doctors special. We speak to doctors from all over the Western world, mainly from the United States, UK, etc. What diabolical scheme could render frontline doctors unable to give treatment to save COVID patients' lives? We'll be hearing about that in a minute. And then censor them from the press and get them sacked from their jobs. Is Dr. Goebbels running Sage and the BBC? What kind of doctor, if anybody, is censoring these people and sacking them? And a look ahead in what Messianic Jew Tim Cohen believes will be a battle for Jerusalem, particularly at the religion of money. The idea that money itself, consumerism, is a religion. It's temples and it's rituals. And you can hear more of my longer interviews, the one we don't get time to broadcast on this stream, on this programme, throughout the rest of the week on this stream. And also, I'll be uploading them tonight at the end of the programme, complete interviews with the various doctors we'll be hearing from tonight. My three books have been published. They were published in the 3 weeks of the Halloween lockdown, The Traitors of Arnhem, which is about the end game of the Second World War and the deals between Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, and Churchill's private secretary, Desmond Morton. Also, The Siege of Heaven, which is the articles I wrote for RT, plus a lot of other material. And around that those subjects, and something called The Siege of Heaven Reader. The Siege of Heaven Reader being a load of extracts since medieval times, which explain, really, the occult role in history. I'll be sending a free version of one of those out with my weekly email. Now, the Google have banned my group, Pepys, which started back in 1996, I think, Power Elite Public Information Service. As Yahoo closed down, I had to move it on to Google, and now Google have just cancelled the list. But if you email me, I can add you to the list. I have to send those out manually. And that's the email address there, and all other details are at thisweek.org.uk. You'll find my email address and the email address for the people that took us off the air here in Bristol. That is to say, Pat Hart, BCFM station manager, and the board who was supposed to oversee it. Incidentally, before Christmas, I sent in a letter to the board. That is over a month ago now. It's just over a month ago, and still haven't received a reply or acknowledgement. The letter, this is the board that's supposed to oversee, the charity that's supposed to oversee BCFM, asking for an explanation as to why this show was taken off back in March, even though we were really at the front line, as many in the UK, of uncovering what's going on with COVID. And subsequently, of course, tens of thousands of people have died, some would say needlessly, with COVID-19, partly because of our show and others, like World Update by Dan Damon on the BBC World Service, being censored by the various broadcasters. So those versions I send out with my weekly emails of those books, which is a watermarked free version, you can actually buy them from the Bilderberg website, via the Bilderberg website. That's www.bilderberg.org. And you'll find all links to that stuff on the contact tab at thisweek.org.uk. And so the Martin Bormann tab on our show page at thisweek.org.uk is where you'll find those books. So when we've finished with what we're doing in a minute, which is chatting around various different subjects, we'll be doing the frontline doctors. So before that, we'll have a bit of a roundup of the main local news and national news, something about Trump. Also, the £50 million, which has been wasted by Bristol's Tony Blair-like so-called Labour Mayor Marvin Rees on the Bristol Energy Project, complete money down the drain of the public, almost looks like a kind of sabotage of local government. And, of course, this is a Tory agenda here. Tories do not want local government. They like central government, and they want to run down government, and they've been doing that ever since David Cameron became Prime Minister back in 2010. We'll also be briefly looking at this whole idea of there now being a recession, which is a bit of a joke since it's been forced on us, almost like committing suicide by central government and by all these measures that Boris has taken to shut down all of our businesses, even though they're able to operate quite safely and put a lot of money and investment into making sure they can operate safely and shifting the goalposts constantly. Looking also at the whole thing of suicide, because for many people, their entire lives plans have been completely in ruins because of these lockdown policies and the constant changing of people's minds, even though the police don't seem to be very enthusiastic about enforcing these policies and some of them laws. The mainstream media keep banging on about in this Goebbels-like style all these things we must do, we mustn't go out of our front door, etc., and our businesses must all just be ruined. Then we're also looking at a little bit of the Great Reset, which is coming up in Davos in the end of January this year in Switzerland, where Prince Charles will be featuring big style there. He's the UK's Davos guy, and he's a big fan of the Great Reset. He wants to see a completely new money system around the world. Well, obviously, that may be a good thing. But we'll be looking at him tonight at the end, along with Tim Cohen, as a kind of Saruman figure, a human person, but he's basically thrown his lot in with the dark side, and he now wants to become the controller of the world's money. Obviously, there are all sorts of dangers in a figure that wants to do that sort of thing, and we'll be looking at those. So some people saying that we should be sabotaging ANPR cameras around the country. That's something I've heard from a couple of people. It'll be interesting to see what Martin says about those, because I know they were introduced originally, these automatic number plate recognition cameras, back in the days of the Northern Ireland Troubles, in order to follow people around and track terrorists. Well, now being used to track people who are going to see their loved ones or going to work or whatever. So interesting that some people are talking about sabotaging those. I suppose also looking at money as a religion, that's what we'll be finishing up with Prince Charles and the section at the end looking at that. Anyway, so I thought we'd best start, thanks for hanging on, Robert, with you over in Hong Kong. Can you just give us a brief explanation of what happened last week? Because as I understand it, over half of the what you would call MPs, we would call MPs anyway, in the Legislative Assembly, were actually arrested in dawn raids. Now, this is a little bit, reminds me a little bit like, we had in our Civil War here, Pride's Purge, where Colonel Pride charged into the House of Commons and arrested all of the members of Parliament that didn't want to kill the King, that wanted to carry on negotiating with Charles the first. And this sort of thing happened actually last week over in Hong Kong. So just take us through it, please.
Okay, last week, around, I think, 55 pro-democracy politicians in Hong Kong were arrested, as you said, in dawn raids by the police. It was on last Wednesday morning under the new national security law. The reason for it was that they had organised something called primaries, because there's supposed to be elections for Parliament or our Legislative Council. They're supposed to have those elections in 2020. And what the Democrats did, just after the national security law had been passed, they held these primaries, and one of the phrases they used was they wanted to get at least 35 Democrat politicians into parliament so they could paralyze the operation of the Hong Kong government. And that was deemed to be breaching the new national security law under the section of subversion, i.e. subverting the rule of law and the role of parliament and the ability of the Hong Kong government to operate effectively. So they were all arrested for subversion under the national security law last Wednesday. And they spent the night in a police cell. And 55 of them arrested, 54 of them are now out, but one remains inside because he failed to hand over his BNO passport. The other people were released, they did hand over their passports, but they haven't got their passports back, so they can't travel. So that's where they are. They were arrested and no passport, cannot travel, and they're awaiting further investigation and possible trial whenever. So that's the latest position on that one. Do you want me to give you some background on how elections work here?
Please do.
Okay.
Because it's actually quite recent, isn't it? Elections. You didn't really have a proper democracy in Hong Kong under Chris Patten and pre-handing it over to China.
That's great. Hong Kong has never been a fully fledged democracy. You've always had the government, if you like, that the government is appointed. All the ministers are appointed. They were appointed originally by Britain when Chris Patten was the last governor. And then when China took over, they were appointed essentially by China. So there was no real difference. It was just the only difference was who's doing the appointing. First it was Britain and then it was China. But on top of that, or underneath the government, we have legislators, and there are a total of 70 legislators who are democratically elected through normal voting, as you would expect in, you know, very similar to the UK. It's that type of voting.
Okay, so what proportion of which type of legislators were actually arrested? And, you know, what, you know, because it's interesting to know, isn't it? You know, was it a third, a quarter?
It wasn't just legislators. It was a mixture of legislators and people supporting the pro-democracy camp that were arrested and rounded up. So one of them was a former lecturer. He actually did prison time for organizing Occupy Central, and his name was Benny Tai. He used to be a lecturer at Hong Kong University. Then because he had a jail term for organizing Occupy Central back in 2014, he was then sacked from his job. But he's always been close to the Democrats, and he helped organize these primaries July 2020 and in preparation for the 2020 elections in September. So he was one of the people arrested. So it was legislators and people supporting the legislators that were arrested, but they were all Democrats that were arrested. In terms of elections in Hong Kong, they are every 4 years. There are two types of elections. There are local council elections or district elections, just like local council elections in the UK. And then there are parliamentary elections, just like the UK. Now, the last local elections were in 2015, and there are a total of 400 seats. The pro-Beijing group, that's people supporting China, held 300 out of those 400 seats, and the Democrats held 100. And that 300 seats gave the pro-Beijing camp control of all 18 districts. Then in 2019, in the district council elections, the pro-establishment lost most of their seats. The whole thing was reversed. The Democrats got 300 and the pro-establishment got 100.
So that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, that's a whole shift in political views. I suppose the obvious question to ask next is the pro-democracy independence from China faction in Hong Kong, is it actually organised? Is it allowed to be organised at the moment? Because it's obviously grown in strength.
Well, there's two things rolled into one there. The Democrats and independents, two separate things. Some people, anybody that argues for independence is breaching the national security law. So that's, if you advocate that, that's you're on your way to prison straight away. On the other hand, some Democrats sort of argued a little bit for that, but they were just not arguing for that. They were arguing for more democracy and more representation by the people, as opposed to pure independence. But just back to the district council thing. So the whole thing was reversed in district councils. Now, district councils, useful, but not that important, because they are not the legislative making body. Now, fearing this, that this would also happen in Parliament, where legislation is made, the COVID virus was perfectly timed, and it allowed, because we're supposed to have the big elections for Parliament in 2020, but because of COVID, they suspended these elections and said we're not going to have them until COVID's gone away.
It's funny because it's in parallel really with what's happened here in Bristol, because we've had last year's elections suspended. We've got a dictatorship now, an unelected mayor who looks as if he's going to try and angle to get another year of unelected on a massive salary that he increased himself, supposedly, for whoever was going to replace him. It's being used as an excuse, I think. It's quite obvious to anybody with a brain cell that you can hold an election during a pandemic, even if it is a pandemic, which it isn't. But if it was, you can. And you have social distancing. You can maybe hold the election over several days if you have a real big problem. But actually, if I've been in here in Bristol, when I go to vote, there's usually nobody in the polling station, maybe sometimes one person or two people. It's certainly very simple to have some kind of social distancing going on there. You could even use, if you really felt like it, some kind of sanitizing spray on the ballot paper. But I don't think they want elections. I think the people behind a lot of this actually rather like dictatorship, Robert.
I think it's the same in Hong Kong and as it is in the UK, as in every other country. I don't think Hong Kong is any different for this. Look, I'll just give you some very basic stats on the virus. In 2019, the government's official figures for flu deaths was 356. For the whole of 2020, flu deaths were down to 113 and COVID deaths were at 146. So if you combine flu and COVID deaths for 2020, you get a grand total of 261 deaths.
Well, this is a bit of a joke, isn't it? Because I've heard also from Ireland that the Irish chief medical officer this week has been saying, thankfully, we have virtually no flu this season.
Well, Hong Kong is obviously not as... it's perhaps more honest than the Irish minister, because they are admitting to 113 flu deaths. So flu does exist in Hong Kong, and then 146 from COVID. But if you take that combined total of 261 compared to 356 flu deaths from 2019, again, it doesn't justify the lockdowns. And not holding the elections. That's my view on this. But I think even, the problem is the Democrats are fully bought into the virus and the mask wearing and the social distancing. Sorry?
You mean in the US?
In Hong Kong.
Okay.
The Hong Kong Democratic Party has bought into the whole virus scamdemic, if you like to call that. They've gone along with it, but they did want the elections. But as a result, so in July 2020, before the actual elections in September, Benny Tai said they wanted to gain the majority in Parliament, and they were on course to do that because it was very likely that the local district results were going to be replicated in the more important parliamentary results, and that the Democrat would at last, in their world, hold this this veto.
Okay, so look, well, the obvious question, Robert, is how have the Hong Kong authorities kept the numbers so low there?
Well, you know, that's a good question. We haven't had a full lockdown like you had in the UK. Most people, but they do close the shops, the restaurants at 6 o'clock at night, and most people would wear a mask. I don't think they particularly work, but most people would wear them. You don't have to wear it if you go running. And what they've also said is you cannot gather in groups of two outside. Again, this is a contradiction because as the last time we spoke, you can have 100 people crammed into an MTR carriage where you've got recycled air, but outside in the fresh air, you can't have more than two people. So again, it seems to me that this is about stopping protest taking place.
Yeah, stopping civil organisation, political organisation. What about track and trace? Have you got that there?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, we have. It's a voluntary system at the moment where you go into restaurants and you're supposed to tap your phone on this, if you've got one of those smartphone things, on the machine. It records what time you enter and what time you actually leave. To divert just a little bit across the water to Singapore, on Monday, last Monday, a week and a bit ago, their police said that they were using the data they were collecting from track and trace to also to aid their criminal investigations. And then the Hong Kong government recently said, we like this idea and we're going to use trace and track also so that we can automatically...
That was a Freudian slip, wasn't it? Trace and trap.
Oh yes, sorry, that was me actually. To automatically record people's whereabouts in the future, and it's going to save them the need to check in and out of places they visit. So, in other words, it's being used to monitor people, to stop social gatherings, to watch you all the time, and this is not a great thing. But unfortunately, the Democrats, as I say, have bought into the fear factor. So, in that sense, there is no real opposition. On serious matters, on what I call the important control factors.
Okay, your day-to-day life, Robert, has it affected you much?
A bit, but not massively. I mean, I still go running three, four times a week. Don't wear the mask for that. You don't have to. We live very close to the sea, so I run along the seafront, and it's quite busy. Normal shops... All the shops are open, small ones and big ones. There's none of this essential services stuff. So that's kind of pretty much okay. I just don't like the masks. If I wear a mask, I feel quite ill, actually. I do get a build-up of phlegm in my body. I feel I can feel the heat. I feel quite bad afterwards. So that makes me feel uncomfortable. But apart from that, not really. No, it's not.
I know during the pro-democracy days, if we can call them that, last year and before, there was a whole system whereby certain businesses would appeal to people who were anti-China, pro-democracy. And is that kind of carried on still, or have the Chinese kind of stopped that? Because I can imagine that they would be really annoyed about that. That's almost like, sort of having IRA shops during the Troubles in Ireland.
That still exists. I mean, there are certain shops that you could say would be pro-democracy, and you could probably say other shops that are pro-establishment as well. So there's kind of a bit of both on that issue taking place. One interesting thing, though, today in court, trial was taking place, and some of the defence barristers wore yellow masks, and the judge ordered them to take off the yellow mask because yellow was seen as a symbol of the of Occupy and the democracy movement. So wearing a yellow mask.
What would happen if they all put swastika masks on?
I don't know. The mask thing to me is just. It's inconsistent. I told you last time I went into court and the judge wasn't wearing them, barristers were not wearing them, but the solicitors had to wear them and everyone else had to wear them. So the whole thing seems to me inconsistent, and it is about this is my view, it is about control, and it is about reinforcing fear. You know, people see the mask, and it reinforces the fear, and that's what I see the mask is all about. But in terms of legal fallout from the protests, there has been quite a bit of legal fallout. There's been, obviously, the arrest of the 55 Democrats last week. A couple of weeks ago, some of the protesters tried to escape to Taiwan and they were caught in the Chinese waters. They were arrested by the mainland authorities and they're serving jail time in China. We also had, I think, in yesterday's Daily Telegraph, it was Malcolm Rifkin, is criticizing David Perry QC for prosecuting some of the protesters in Hong Kong. He's flying from London to Hong Kong to do another case here. And he's going to be prosecuting some of the protesters, including...
Well, I find this absolutely extraordinary, the idea that the Chinese Communist Party would... bring across a British QC in order to do the prosecution of the pro-democracy people there?
Because, well, the trial's going to be in English, and David Perry's got, in Hong Kong, he's got a good record of gaining successful prosecutions. So they like him, and he get paid absolutely ridiculous stackloads of money. He will earn more in a week than most people will earn in 5 years.
It seems to me what we've got is a whole stable of puppet judges, puppet politicians, who the establishment know that they have got all sorts of techniques to win cases, including, you know, cooperation with the surveillance services, the security services, and that's that kind of thing, enabling them to win a case by cheating, basically, but still with a smile on their face, running away with a lot of money. So I think that seems to be what's going on here, is that this guy has got some sort of relationship. And will, for example, I mean, will there be a jury in this case, do you know?
No, I think this is a judge case, because this is in the lower courts, and the maximum sentence for this is 7 years. That's another strange thing that I'm uncomfortable about, in terms of most of these protest cases are not being held in front of a jury. And I like juries quite a lot. I think Michael Mansfield QC once described juries as an equalizer. So even if somebody might technically be guilty, the jury may say, well, okay, technically they protested, technically they did not have police approval for this protest, but the jury might say, but we think it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to sort of sit alongside a lot of the censorship going on, because I know one of the people being prosecuted in this by David Perry is Jimmy Lai. Can you just tell us a bit about him?
Jimmy Lai's got two cases going on at the moment.
May be prosecuting both, it looks like.
I'm not sure. Jimmy Lai one's going to come quite a bit later. He's also involved in this one starting on the 16th of February with Martin Lee, senior counsel, and Margaret Ng, senior counsel. And both Martin Lee and Margaret Ng were awarded the International Bar Association Award for Human Rights for the Defense of Freedom and Democracy in Hong Kong. So maybe that also probably annoyed mainland authorities as well. Maybe that's why they've been targeted. And part of that group of protesters was Jimmy Lai. So he's also in court on the 16th of February in that case as well, for organizing a protest in 2019.
Yeah, because David Perry is going to be representing the prosecution in the trial of Jimmy Lai too.
This one, yes. And I'm not sure who's doing the big prosecution for Jimmy Lai is the breach of the national security law, because he's got a newspaper called the Apple Daily, and they raided his offices, and they've charged him with breaching national security for encouraging and engaging the help of foreign countries to undermine the Chinese authority in Hong Kong.
Well, look, let's cut to the chase, Robert, because you're implying all sorts of things here about difficult. Some of the basic freedoms seem to be being stripped away, prosecuted, destroyed in Hong Kong. Where is this all heading? Do you think Hong Kong can survive as a sort of, maybe more Anglophile, or is it just going to simply kind of have to come under the thumb of President Xi? Because one thing that really concerns me about this guy is he doesn't allow any kind of real criticism of him. You could not have something like Private Eye over in China, because anyone that even so much as spoke before they even wrote an article and published it would be arrested by Xi.
Yeah, I think the problem of this all started with the major protests in, time goes by quickly, 2019. And until that actually happened, I would say Hong Kong was still the best place to live in the world, even though President Xi Jinping was in power in China. But things came off the rails with...
Hang on. Why do you say that, the best place to live in the world?
Best because you got a lot of freedom. There was none of this political correctness, so people were never on edge about what you could say about anything. You could say total freedom, very, very free to say whatever you wanted until 2019. It was probably one of the safest places to live in Hong Kong. You could go to the expensive parts or the poorer parts and walk down the street, and you were never going to be attacked by anybody. It's one of the most efficient cities in the world to move around. The transport is excellent. It's Hong Kong is an island, and it's also got small islands around it. So if you want
it's
to get away,
I will also say to listeners, it's also very reasonably priced and very efficient. The public transport getting across on the ferry from Kowloon to Hong Kong and to the outer islands is very quick and very cheap. If you wanted to pay a bit more, you can go on a hydrofoil or something, but the ferries are fantastic.
They are, and they're very regular. They're like every 15 minutes. And on a ferry bobbling across the sea from one part of Hong Kong to another is a fantastic way to travel. I compare that with life in the UK, and I say Hong Kong's way ahead of in terms of quality of life here than anywhere else in the world. Plus, I've had a very lucky time here. I've met some fascinating people. And done some really, really fascinating things, which, I never had those opportunities in the UK. So for me, Hong Kong has been a fantastic place. But after the protests in 2019, I think China said, look, we're not going to have any more of this. This is a problem. And there's been this crackdown. And, there's no idea where it's going to actually end at the moment. And that's the big concern, because there is now the fallout from the protest. Now we've got the virus, everybody's clamped down. There is now the fallout of rounding up the people doing the protests, taking them to court. And the problem is, as people get more and more powerful, they tend to abuse the power. And, there's a feeling that they're out to really crush the middle class completely. So you're going to be ending up with a few true Beijing supporters and just a lot of workers who will not criticize at the bottom. And that seems to be the feeling how it's going, which is a sad thing to happen to Hong Kong.
Well, it's tragic. But listen, before you go, let's just hear from Martin Summers. Martin, if you could just unmute your mic and let us know what you make of what Robert's got to say about what's happening there. Obviously, they're in a situation where they don't have a lot of choice. There's an enormous great superpower right on their doorstep. And their freedom, I'm afraid, is going to be ripped up and put in the bin if it suits the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, well, I think... what's just been said there by Robert about the protests, I think the Chinese government was fairly relaxed about the situation in Hong Kong before, but the protests themselves have led to a situation where they feel that they can't afford to be seen to be weak. And that's a shame because in any case, they're very paranoid about the idea of independence for Hong Kong, because obviously that's, from their point of view, an absolute no-no. Under other circumstances, were world politics less confrontational, you could imagine that there would have been a more easygoing attitude all round. But that's not the situation we're in.
Yeah, can I just come in a little bit on that as well? I'm I I'm pretty sure that there was a lot of actually foreign interference trying to cause a lot of trouble in Hong Kong, leading up to these protests. I'll give you two concrete examples from my own experience. I've done a few sort of professions in my life. My latest one was a barrister, and I qualified in 1996, practiced a little bit in London, and then eventually moved to Hong Kong. And I bring across a lot of leading QCs from London and help promote them in Hong Kong. So I know a lot about the legal market and how it actually works. And
Robert Perry, no?
David Perry.
Sorry, yeah.
He's not one that I've worked with, but I'm very much aware of him.
I'm glad to hear that. Okay.
I'm very much aware of him and very much aware of his techniques. And I don't like his techniques. I think as a as a slight diversion, as a prosecuting barrister, you're supposed to present the case as it is, not exaggerate it, not blow it up. But Perry always blows it up. He always opens big and takes a lot of chances, and he's been getting away with it. And that's not good. I think there's only one barrister that I know quite well that stood up to him. That was John Kelsey Fry. And, you know, I think Perry's actually scared of him in every way possible. And he's probably the person, if anybody was defending, would be one of half a dozen that I would go
back to the evidence for there being evidence in the protest.
Okay, one of the first barristers I brought across to Hong Kong was somebody called Mark Warby QC, and he's now Mr. Justice Warby. I'm not sure if Martin remembers it, but a couple of weeks ago, he's now a judge in the High Court, and an appeal case came to him, and he ruled that people have a right to offend other people. And that was, he's quite famous for that. He's a, you know, quite a famous judge now in the UK. But he came across with me in about 2013. We gave a talk at the Foreign Correspondents Club. It's on YouTube. It's still there. And in the audience, we had Edward Snowden's barrister. And it turns out later that also the CIA in the audience. Because when we're walking down the steps of the Foreign Correspondents Club, this guy comes out of nowhere, shows the badge, CIA, can I please talk to you? So he takes Mark Warby QC into just somewhere around the corner, and then I wait. I said, what was that all about? I said, no real problem. They just wanted to know if I knew the whereabouts of Edward Snowden. So, A, there are operatives in Hong Kong. I've seen it. I've experienced it. The second one would be to see, again, the Americans linking up with one of the famous protesters, Joshua Wong, in the Conrad Hotel. This was the American consulate, and that was just before the big protests. So I think, yes, there is deliberate interference from outside into Hong Kong. So in a sense, this is kind of offering a defense for China here, that they had rights to be concerned about what was happening. And I think to some extent, a lot of these protests were maybe manipulated, encouraged, possibly funded from outside people. And they played upon the fear that they were promoting democracy, which Hong Kong didn't have democracy in terms of being able to elect the chief executive in the government. And they were trying to argue you should have that right. They played upon that, and this is how they fuel the protests. And things have turned very bad for Hong Kong, which takes me to a bigger political point. Are there a few people in the world deliberately creating trouble throughout the world, you know, to create situations like we've got in Hong Kong? And perhaps they don't really care about democracy at all. They're more about caring about destroying Hong Kong. So I can see why China is concerned. And at the same time, I can see why people are concerned that there's been a crackdown on freedom at the same time. I can see, you know, I've seen on the inside of this at very close levels from many different angles. And that's my analysis at the moment of
what's okay. I mean, one of the people who has a long tradition of having his tentacles, if you can call them that, or his spider legs in both camps of the West and China is Henry Kissinger, Robert.
He is, and along with the Rockefeller Institute, and they are very close, I think, again, just kind of reading between the lines, they are very close to the Chinese Communist Party. And I say I wouldn't trust the Rockefeller Institute as far as I could throw them. But again, you know, they could be, I don't know the conversations that have taken place, but they are very big in China. Talking about the, as we're on the law thing, I just want one sentence on Julian Assange. You may have played it to death, but just giving a bit of a legal input to it and sort of seeing these situations played out a few times in my own life and with barristers I've worked with, it seems to me that the judge has set him up to be extradited to America, because the way the judge ruled in that case was about the suicide, and you know, about him, he may commit suicide and he'd be a health problems if he goes to America. That's a very easy one to overcome on an appeal, because he's already in a prison in England, and the appeal's going to go, I think, this way, to say, well, America will say, we can have protection for him in an American cell better than the UK, and they'll bring in all sorts of arguments to say we've got these great levels of protection, and I think on appeal he will be extradited. That's just my unfortunate negative opinion on it, but I think he's been set up by the judge.
Martin?
Well, coming to the last thing first with Assange, the stuff I've been reading suggests that he possibly won't be extradited, but only on these medical grounds. In other words, what the judge, and it's not, you know, it's a fairly low-level judge, and it's Baretza, isn't it, who's in the court at Belmarsh or wherever it is. They basically found in favour of the US's interpretation of their own Espionage Act that anybody who, you know, breaks their official secrets, even if they haven't signed any Official Secrets Act, is prosecutable. So they've got what they wanted from this, in the sense that anybody anywhere can be prosecuted for under the US Espionage Act, which first came in 1917 and was used against the anti-war activists like Eugene Debs, who was the head of the Socialist Party, who was sent to prison, which is extraordinary to my mind. I mean, I didn't know you were a barrister, Robert, but it seems extraordinary to me that something extraterritorial like that can be enforced in Britain. I mean, the Espionage Act in the US is highly controversial. And in the early 60s, they passed a law to say that it was universally applicable across the whole planet. And British courts seem to be agreeing with them, which I find extraordinary.
Yeah. Again, I think it's being involved in this profession, seeing the different angles of it, that quite often judgments are rigged in a way to achieve the outcome they want. That's why I'm just concerned about what may happen. I can see a setup that could occur. It may not. I think you may be well right, Martin. But
well, they seem to be holding him in Belmarsh anyway. You know, the U.S. government is going to appeal. And yeah, Don't forget, he's been essentially held in solitary confinement for years. You know, why can't he be bailed? And he can't. You know, it's an affront to everything that I understand by English common law. And coming back to Hong Kong, I mean, there is a pro let's try and get on with China faction in the deep state in the US. Kissinger, of course, famously persuaded Nixon to go to meet with Mao Zedong in the 1970s. And that was all part of the game that Kissinger was playing to isolate the Soviet Union. And if you look at Kissinger's recent prognostications, he's basically saying fairly openly, we've got to decide if we're going to fight with Russia, then we've got to be friendly with China, or vice versa. But we can't afford to alienate both of them simultaneously. And of course, the only thing that anybody can agree about in mainstream US politics is that we hate both of them. Who are we going to go after first? And of course, the problem in the modern world is that everybody actually, you know, in China and in Russia, most of the senior people speak English and they can follow all of this in English and they can see this debate being conducted. And, you know, it doesn't basically make them feel very secure.
Well, we could have some news on Snowden and Assange within the next 24 hours, but don't hold your breath, folks. Apparently, Trump has said to journalists that he will make a decision about pardoning Assange and Snowden by the weekend. So he's got about another 12 or so hours to make that announcement, if he does. I mean, there's all sorts of things a president in his position can do. But the thing is, he's under the cosh at the moment with this. And maybe before we say goodbye, Robert, you could just give us your thoughts on what's been going on in the United States, the so-called storming of the Capitol building, which some of the reports that I've seen since then appear to show that the protesters were basically let in by the police.
This seems to me it's almost replicating what happened in Hong Kong. We had a storming of the Legislative Council, the Parliament building in Hong Kong, as part of the protests. And again, the impression was, were they kind of like led in there? And once they got into the Legislative Council, the Parliament, they removed all the symbols of China and put up the British flags. You know, it's everything in the world now is just seeming so incredibly orchestrated. And, you know, you think, is there this central controlling body that is orchestrating the thing in America and the thing in China? That's my kind of thoughts on it, on the international side of things. Yeah, so that's it.
What about your thoughts on Trump generally? What's going to happen to him? Is he going to be impeached, do you think? Is there any point to all of this? It does seem as if the main object is nothing to do with, you know, due process of law. It's to just try and make sure that he doesn't become a political force during the Biden era and then come romping back in 4 years' time.
Oh, I'm not too sure. I mean, he talked about, when he was elected, about chasing after Hillary Clinton and sort of throwing the law book at her. But it seems to me that once you get rid of them, you may enter into some kind of private deal to say, just go away quietly. We don't want any trouble and let us get on. You get on. And, you know, that's probably the end of it. I think it'll just go quietly in the end. I think the storm will calm down and it'll just go away.
Martin?
It's very hard to predict, obviously. I think, you know, what has just been suggested by Robert is quite possible.
Yeah, do you want to just give us your take on, you know, to what extent this is like kind of like a colour revolution thing where you get a great big mob out in the street
definitely manipulation. If you were to say to me, were there agents provocateurs in those demonstrations in US and Hong Kong, my answer would overwhelmingly be yes. Virtually every demonstration anybody ever goes on of any significance has got agents provocateurs within the crowd. But that doesn't mean that they're all operating to the same instructions. It just means that the same methods are being used, because those are the methods that you use, whoever you are. It doesn't mean that people using those methods are all on the same side.
They had Republican senators in the Congress directing the demonstrators. There was at one point one of them was directing them up the stairs, go this way, don't make sure you don't smash anything, or these Republican senators weren't sitting in the chamber. They had somehow been briefed that all these people were going to be coming flowing in and where to send them.
Well, I mean, if we're going to start a big top discussion of what happened on the Capitol, I'm happy to go there. but there's a lot to say about it if we're going to discuss all the, because more and more stuff's coming out, you know, almost by the hour about what actually happened there. And of course, people's phone footage is being viewed and so on and so forth.
Okay. Well, anyway, before we do that, before we do that, let's just give the final word to Robert. I wonder if you've got any particular places that you think listeners can go to actually get a good take on what's really going on in Hong Kong, and whether it's still possible to visit Hong Kong before it all becomes, controlled by the Pope or President Xi.
At the moment, actually, I mean, planes have been, this is a problem for me, planes have been banned from leaving England and arriving in Hong Kong. So I don't know how David Perry's going to get here, actually, when I think about that, because they've banned all flights from the UK to Hong Kong. So he's going to have to go on a very interesting route to get into
mainland China. Maybe he'll get a briefing in Beijing.
I don't know, but he's going to have to. I don't know. I'm not sure how he's going to get. There are no flights currently at the moment. And previous to that, if you were flying in here from the UK, you then had to do 21 days quarantine in a hotel. So not sure. But I think as a place to visit, I think Hong Kong is probably a wonderful place to visit. And I think maybe it'll become a great place again, actually. But what will happen is it just won't be like I knew it when I first came here. And that'll be, you know, the disappointment in it. But I think maybe for some,
certainly a challenge to visit at the moment.
It's certainly a challenge at the moment. But maybe when everything settles down in a few years' time, I would bet that, you know, teachers, bankers, lawyers will still wanting to become and work in Hong Kong, take the high salaries. And I still would say that, you know, people will still want to come on holiday here. And it's,
what about news outlets? Obviously, Jimmy Lai's being shut down. But are there any good websites or newspapers over there?
No, I mean, not really. I don't actually like any of them, because there's two aspects to it. One is that they either, all of them support the global agenda, which I'm with global agenda, I mean cashless society, smart city, global warming scam, and the COVID and pro-vaccine. And it doesn't matter which newspaper you go to, that's what you're going to get. All of them are going to give you the same outcome on that. So there's nothing that I'd really recommend if you want a total neutral position on anything. But all media.
What about the Asia Times? Something like that?
Possibly, but I don't think I've read the Asia Times actually for bloody ages. I just can't recommend anything. Can I have just the last word on something else, actually? Because I'm thinking about coming back to the UK, and obviously I'm concerned about what's going on there as well. And I'm concerned, there's a couple of things I'm concerned about, particularly with the way sometimes people are saying, recommending to other people, oh, go out there, carry on as normal, open your shop, go in there without the mask and take it to the people, to the establishment. I think, you know, as an individual, you see these arrests in supermarkets. People don't wear a mask, then the supermarket people come, the local council come, the police come, and they arrest somebody. And it seems like these people are sometimes just let down by people encouraging them to go and do it. So I think what might be useful on the mask thing, if you want to get a definitive answer, would be, rather than leaving people exposed by this, all get together somehow, fund a solicitor or a voluntary solicitor to go with somebody in a supermarket, don't wear a mask, let the person get arrested, give them free legal representation so they're not stressed out by it, and find out just what is the current legal position for not wearing a mask in supermarkets. Because,
well, I mean, the interesting thing, Robert, is that I don't know if you've seen this, but there was an announcement by the National Police Chiefs Councils last week saying that they would not be arresting people who weren't wearing masks in shops.
Well, that's good, because I've seen still a few videos on the YouTube network of you know, people going to the supermarket and the person saying, I've got an exemption. They read out the law, which is pretty darn clear. If you have a medical exemption, you don't have to tell people what that exemption is. You don't have to produce any evidence of that. And yet the police were just saying, I've had enough of this, I'm going to arrest you because you're not giving me your name and address. And they literally cuffed the guy and march him off. And it's, people are getting a lot of aggro for this. And we've got shops now saying, and banks saying, you can't enter without a mask. Well, the, even the government's own website is saying you don't have to wear a mask. I think that needs to be clarified.
Yeah, I mean, no, Robert, that's extremely rare, that sort of thing. Although, of course, it does often get picked up by the mainstream press, who seem to be doing the best they can to scare everybody.
Ah, okay, okay. But my point is, I don't like
scaring you too.
Maybe, but I don't like people being left out. You know, when sort of people say, "Oh, go out there, go and do that," and then some poor guy goes and does it, and he's left all alone and taking all the aggro. You know, I think people should support each other a bit more.
I mean,
more.
Yeah, traditionally in protests, and I think this is probably true for the pro-democracy movement very much so, in Hong Kong, is that part of the responsibility of organising any kind of protest is to make sure you've got legal briefings for everybody, and you've got a, you know, a lawyer that they can call if anything happens. Otherwise, you shouldn't be organising a protest.
Yeah, it's when maybe the independent media is encouraging individuals to kind of break the rules, and these individuals are left all alone, and then finding themselves in very stressful situations. I think, you know, that's not a good thing to happen. There's three things I think to look at in terms of winning the battle, if you want, against the COVID scam. One is the law, public relations, and physical control. We need to clarify just what the law is. And that's why I'm so disappointed by Starmer, the human rights lawyer. He knows the mask thing's a problem. He knows there are contradictions here quite clearly. Supermarkets and banks say masks must be worn, and yet the own government guidelines and the Equalities Act make it pretty clear that if you have a disability, you don't have to wear the mask. I think Starmer is really, really letting people down on this, given his human rights background.
Let me just intervene a sec, because I came across one protest which was organised, I think it was organised in Stroud a few months ago in Gloucestershire, a couple of months ago. And I heard from one of the organisers that the police turned up mob-handed with about five or six vans of police with their, you know, shields and whatever and truncheons. And they went over to one of the organisers, who then had a legal discussion with them. They went back to talk to the actual, whoever it was, the head superintendent in charge. And all the police got into the vans and drove off, because they realised that the group that was that they were about to be trying to stop their a meeting or whatever, or organisation, actually fell within the law. This is the more recent law, not the one that was operative during the time around about October, when they tried to stop all of the protests. And so the police just went home. So there is some provision for some kind of organisation. I think you've just got to be very clear with the police what the law is, and maybe even clear with the people turning up. Anyway, Robert, is there anything else finally you wanted to say?
Yeah, I do. Boots, I think, are wanting to bring out vaccinations, quick vaccinations for people. I think in terms of when I look at the large protests in London, I think there's a lot of energy there, and protests take energy. So, is there some way to use it a little bit wiser? So, for example, if Boots are going to start having vaccination, why not gather close to Boots and hand out small leaflets making the case against vaccination? So at the point where people are making the decision to go into Boots, they get the notice about the downside of vaccinations. I think this kind of, you know, use of resources in terms of targeting, not in a bad way, not in a violent way or anything, but information targeting is more efficient use of protest than walking along the street going, freedom, freedom, freedom. It doesn't do too – it's useful, but it's not doing as much good, or it's not as effective of having the leaflets, say, outside Boots. And I think another thing people can go and do is handwritten letters to sports celebrities who are going to be used to market the vaccine and saying, look, vaccines do have problems. Please consider this before you go and promote it. And you can send to any sports star you want via Manchester United. Just name the footballer X via Man United, X via Chelsea, or X via his manager. Anybody can do this if you're in lockdown, rather than using the energy of, you know, marching along the street. It's useful, but, you know, use it a little bit wiser in terms of being more effective, so that individuals are not picked off And we have to win the PR battle. That's the PR part, is moving these, is getting these letters out to people, celebrities, and making people aware and getting outside boot. But again, in a group of people. So you're more protected in a group than you are as an individual. Don't leave individuals hung out to dry. I think that's something I'm not too happy about. And the other thing, of course, is always use cash whenever you can. I'm concerned that buses and more places now are saying you've got to use some kind of a contactless payment. That's one step away from tracing, and it's one step away from social crediting, and that needs to happen. And if you are going to protest, remember, you see, the problem is that banks and supermarkets and places, they have physical control. They have their thugs and their bouncers at the door. And if little individual shows up, you're going to be intimidated. But if a lot of people show up, you've got support within that group. I think just better organisation of protests and targeted protesting is something that is really needed in the UK. That's what I want to say.
Okay, well, thanks ever so much, Robert Hanson, for joining us once again. A bit late there. It must be nearly 2 a.m. in Hong Kong, so
it's
time for bed. Thank you ever so much for bringing us up to date from the front line, really, between the West and China, this kind of conflict which is brewing with, it seems like, the Middle East in the middle. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you for having me on.
Now, Martin, what do you make of the... of this whole sort of situation between the West and the East, with Hong Kong as a pivot point, really, isn't it? Where is it all heading, do you think?
Well, widening the focus. I mean, Hong Kong is one, place of friction between the Western powers, or the US in particular, and China. But of course, we're now moving into a situation where, you know, the Chinese economy has basically bounced back from what happened within the initial phases of the crisis. But the US economy is still mired in deflation and lockdown. And my own view is that this whole crisis is to do with this, what they call the Thucydides trap, which is a book that came out not long ago, basically comparing the relationship between China and the US to that between Athens and Sparta in the Peloponnesian War, that the Athenians were becoming stronger and stronger. The Spartans didn't like the idea that the Athenians were going to become top dog or potentially top dog. So they began a war against Athens in order to prevent, because they were basically jealous of the possibility that they would become top nation inside the Greek, the Greek political system as it existed at that time. I don't think we're doomed to repeat the past just because it is the past. But nevertheless, there's massive lobbying power in the US, particularly the military industrial complex, that if we don't deal with China now, they're going to be in a position where we won't be able to deal with them further down the line. And that may, of course, be underlying this whole crisis, because as we've discussed in previous weeks, it may be that the COVID-19 virus is in fact a bioweapon. And of course, Trump's people are going to push the idea that it is a bioweapon and that it leaked from the Wuhan laboratory in the next week or so. Although I understand that the mainstream deep state, if you like, in the UK and the US are going to poo-poo the idea, which is why you had Boris Johnson going on about how it came from pangolins and so on the other day. But, I mean, underlying all of this, even if it's a natural virus, there is still massive confrontation going on across the developing world between China and the West, because the Chinese want to carry out a massive investment in developing countries to basically upgrade their technical infrastructure. And this is perceived as a massive threat by the Western multinational companies, who regard the developing world as their playground.
Okay, now let's move on to look at some other stories. I mean, we've been talking a bit about Trump there. I suppose the obvious thing to do is to have a bit of a listen to you know, some of the things that have been going on over in the US. Particularly good, I thought, was, and sometimes they're a bit patchy, but Democracy Now this week did a really, I think, very good assessment. And as part of that, we'll have a listen to that now. It's about 5 minute long altogether, but it's an analysis by Chris Hedges. And Chris has actually come into his own in many ways because, well, I say he's come into his own, but he's been being censored left, right and centre. Do you want to say a little bit about who he is, Martin, before we hear from him?
Well, I'm not massively knowledgeable about him, but he's been around for quite a while. And he was a mainstream journalist, and he's very critical of the way in which the US political system has evolved over the last decades.
Yeah, he's been completely marginalised and censored from various of the social media platforms, very much like Trump, although he's not actually himself a fanatical Trumpite by any means. He's just a journalist doing his job. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to Chris Hedges talking about the storming of the White House and the subsequent destruction of Trump's Twitter and Facebook, etc. accounts.
Twitter, all of these digital platforms are not neutral arbiters. In fact, they're, of course, for-profit corporations with close ties to the security state. And if you look back over the past few years, they have imposed heavy forms of censorship and interference, primarily on the left and in particularly on WikiLeaks. So they blocked the ability for WikiLeaks to accept donations on PayPal and every other platform. Every time WikiLeaks would hold a press conference, there would be interference, electronic interference. People couldn't get in the room. They've used algorithms. And then we saw, again, their very partisan activity during the campaign when they locked the New York Post out of its own Twitter account, because it had published stories about the revelations found on the discarded or abandoned laptop from Hunter Biden, which in retrospect have proven quite serious. Glenn Greenwald took a very heroic stance on this, and The Intercept wouldn't publish his story. So to allow these opaque, and remember, these companies know everything about us. We know nothing about them. To allow these companies to essentially function as de facto platforms for censorship and manipulation, and I'm not in any way minimizing what happened last week, harkens back to the way civil liberties were eviscerated in the wake of 9/11. The Patriot Act, which the great civil rights attorney Michael Ratner called a coup d'etat, the 2002 Authorization to Use Military Force Act. So responding to a crisis, and I think we do live in a crisis. I have written about this right-wing nativist fascist. My book, American Fascist, came out in 2006. So I'm very cognizant of the very real threat that we face. But to respond by, in essence, empowering these private corporations to function as censors over billions of people will come back to haunt us. And we see that because it's not just Trump they target. It's always, in the end, the left that pays for this kind of censorship.
Mm-hmm. Not all speech in this country is to say the least, simply allowed. I mean, you're not supposed to be able to yell fire in a crowded theater, for example. As you pointed out, you yourself have been warning for years about American fascism. How does President Trump, the support for this insurrection, not fall into that category for you?
Because he doesn't specifically call for violence. And, you know, this goes back to the attempt on the state of Mississippi to go after the NAACP for violence that had been carried out, trying to blame the NAACP for this violence. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, I think, 1982. And they ruled essentially, it was a unanimous decision, that this kind of speech, the kind of speech that Trump laid out, is actually protected, and even if it results in violence, they can't go after the person who carried out that speech. So, if you give a strong, in that case, said that if you give a strong speech against segregation and that there is some kind of violence carried out, you're not responsible. So, I think that I would love to see Trump impeached. Ralph Nader and Bruce Fein have drawn up a list of 12 real impeachable offenses, not just a shakedown of Ukraine. But of course, I think the Democratic Party has been complicit in this administration. They could have impeached Trump the first week just on the emoluments clause alone, the perpetuation of nine wars, if we count Yemen, that were never declared by Congress. But they didn't do it because they saw Trump as a fundraising tool. The media has made tons of money off of Trump. Again, as was pointed out, the digital platforms love Trump as essentially keeping people on their platforms, again, profit-driven. And now we've ended up in the final week of the Trump administration with people attempting to respond to the deterioration of the American political system and the judiciary and the checks and balances and everything else. But I think that the clearly, if we kind of coldly read what Trump said to his supporters, he didn't call for people to break into the Capitol and take people hostage.
No, he didn't, did he? But that's kind of... Martin, what do you make of the way this is all playing out now? Because, as I said when we were chatting with Robert, it does look as if the main aim is to stop Trump standing in 4 years' time when it comes to 2025. Going to get my years right, this seems to be a way of blocking him potentially.
Well, there's the impeachment, which has just been mentioned, and then there is potential criminal charges, which will be a separate thing. I think what you've got now, the impeachment is going forward. It's got through the Congress. It now has to go to the Senate. And there's quite a substantial chunk of Republicans who are quite keen to see that Trump is not allowed to stand for public office again, because they want to stand for public office. And if he's still there, he gets in their way. So it may well be that what will happen is it will go through both houses of Congress. The Democrats will all vote to impeach a certain number of Republicans. I mean, in the Congress, 10 Republicans voted with the Democrats. Democrats have got a majority anyway in the Congress, but 10 Republicans voted with the Democrats, including Liz Cheney, who is number three in their internal hierarchy, the daughter of Dick Cheney. And I think that, there are establishment-oriented, if you like, Republicans who are quite keen to see Trump not allowed to stand, so that then other people can try and take over his role. But that's probably the way it's going to play out.
But Martin, what do you make of all the claims about this being a sort of Orange Revolution operation in the States, stage managed for the media? We've seen a lot of frenetic, particularly from ITV, reporting, very, very tense, as if this is kind of mob rule. But isn't that the way that these things are supposed to appear?
Well, I don't think, each situation is unique to itself. You can't just presume that every political riot or whatever it is the same as every other one.
Yeah, but hang on a minute, because look, just a minute. You've got the Congress building is secure. It wasn't. There are all sorts of methods that they can use to keep doors closed. And also that there is actually a kind of massive, great iron, black iron fence that runs right around it. And it seemed, certainly the way I saw it, looking at it, these gates seem to have been deliberately left open so that the Congress building itself could be directly approached by this crowd. So, and also that the evidence that you've got Republican senators hanging around inside waiting to direct people, certainly there's enough evidence from I can see that this was pre-planned and orchestrated and organized.
If it was pre-planned by the Republicans and by Trump,
By the police.
Yeah, but the police, the Capitol police, are unique. All they do is guard the Capitol. Now, there's all sorts of questions being asked about this in the mainstream media in the US. Why were the police so lackadaisical in this situation. And there's evidence that some of the police sympathise with the demonstrators. That's coming out. There's also evidence, I mean, it's quite straightforward. When Black Lives Matter protested outside the White House last summer, there were 5,000 riot police between them and the White House. And then the riot police cleared away the private the peaceful demonstrators with tear gas and pepper spray and all the rest of it, so that Trump could walk across the street to stand outside a church and give a speech, which then caused problems. Now, what clearly comes to the top of everybody's mind is, where were the 5,000 riot police on this occasion? Now, it's quite clear that somebody made a decision for them not to be there. We're still trying to assess who made that decision and on what basis. So that will give you a clue to who was responsible for what happened. But of course, the other thing that happened is Trump had got permission for his rally, and that's, everybody came to the rally. It's called Women for America, I think, got permission for the rally. They discussed it with the police. The police says, yes, you can have a rally, and they had the rally where they had it, but they had no permission to march to the Capitol. And Trump's legal advisors told him that he didn't have permission to march to the Capitol. What he told the protesters was that he was going to march to the Capitol with them, even though they didn't have permission to do that. What he actually did is got in his car and drove back to the White House. And then a section of the demonstration moved off towards the Capitol.
It wasn't, I mean, he was using the various journalists have made a lot of the fact that he was saying, oh, we've got to fight. This isn't necessarily, I mean, we all know the word fight doesn't necessarily mean you've got to go and punch the police.
It
can mean an illegal fight too, can't it? It can mean anything.
Yes,
it's like
yes.
a jihad.
Chris Hedges made that point.
A fight with weapons, or it can be an internal spiritual fight.
Yes. That's all clear. But what's not clear is that he said, told them to march to the Capitol, which he didn't, that they didn't have permission to do that. Okay, so he told them to do that. He said he was going to lead them, but he didn't. He went away and he left them to go and do it.
I mean, I'm reminded also of the big demonstration outside the White House of Black Lives Matter protesters. And they tried to storm the White House, didn't they? Threw bricks and bottles at police, set things on fire, including in St. John's Church there. I mean, you do wonder if
that particular demonstration was relative. There have been confrontations, as we know, on Black Lives Matter demonstrations. But that one was actually, what happened was the police attacked a demonstrator so that they could clear the front of the church so that Trump could come out of the White House and give a presser outside the church. But in any case, there was no right to march from the protest to the Capitol. And when they got there, there was no police protecting the building. As a previous, I mean, you know, in the summer, there was just literally thousands of riot police armed to the teeth.
But, I mean, the Black Lives Matter demonstration, Martin, outside the White House, and they didn't get into the White House, but the security felt it was necessary to take President Trump down into his underground bunker used during terrorist attacks.
Yeah, well, there were several protests. There wasn't just one. Okay, because if you remember, it went on for several weeks, months even.
No, there was one. There was one particular one outside the White House, Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, all right, but that was that one. There was another one where Trump crossed the road to the church, yeah, and the police attacked the demonstrators who went and attacked them in order to clear them out of the way for Trump to go to the church.
I suppose the best way to round this up is to look at what you think may happen next Wednesday. Do you think it's all going to go calmly, or are we going to get militias and gun-toting Trumpites on the streets?
Well, no, because what's going to happen? I mean, there's already been pictures which I saw on Newsround, which is for kids yesterday. The National Guard are already sleeping inside the Capitol. The police will not want to be seen to be caught napping by any kind of protest that may or may not occur. And of course, Trump himself has basically now said to his people not to cause any violence. It doesn't cause, it doesn't help his cause, which of course it doesn't. I mean, in many ways, this whole passage of play, if you like, has put Trump on the back foot. It looks like a majority of opinion polls are suggesting that they want him to be impeached. Yeah. So in other words, even though he got 70 plus million votes in the election, a majority now want him to be impeached. And that will be reflected in both Congress and in the Senate, and it'll probably go through and he will be impeached. And what the punishment will be is he won't be able to stand for public office again. And of course, Ivanka is saying that she is going to go to his daughter, is going to, was saying that she was going to go, apparently, this is the gossip anyway, that she was going to go to the Biden inauguration because she fancies taking over her father's role. And she's not, you know, apparently they're not speaking anymore. And Trump and Giuliani have fallen out because Giuliani has been charging Trump $20,000 a day for all these legal challenges he's been making to the results, which have got them absolutely nowhere because the courts have refused to look at them. So the politics of it don't look good for Trump. The general political situation is still highly tense because there's a great deal of recrimination and division. And underlying all of this, I mean, what gets me about the Trump people is that they're trying to accuse the Venezuelans and the Chinese Communist Party of rigging the election. If the election was rigged, it was rigged by the CIA, the people who carried out the 9/11 attack, which, of course, Trump basically pointed to by saying that when the buildings collapsed, they must have been bombed. And, you know, this is all a storm in a teacup compared to 9/11. Yeah, 9/11 was a really big challenge to democracy in the US. This is theatrics by comparison.
So don't you think, I mean, surely what we're going through now with the enormous clampdowns around the world with COVID is actually is bigger than 9/11 in many ways. It's affecting far, far more people. And as we're going to be hearing after the break, there are an enormous number of countries who have coped very well with it because there are things which are very basic cures, like chloroquine, ivermectin is not something that people normally take. But one of the reasons that there's been very few deaths in many parts of Africa is because people are taking chloroquine anyway to avoid catching malaria. And if they're doing that, then it means that they're very unlikely to catch COVID. So this is a preventable thing. So would you think it's a bit trite to compare 9/11 with COVID, because they're both both had an enormous effect. And the other problem, of course, is that this whole war on terror, which was going on forever, these endless wars, it seems now they've got an endless war against the virus.
Okay, well, we started off comparing what had happened in the Capitol with 9/11, and we've moved on to COVID. Now, COVID, in my view, Tony, and I can't prove this, is a biological warfare agent, probably from Fort Detrick. It leaked possibly by accident last year, and eventually we may find out that it didn't, in fact, start in China. It started in the US. But there's too many things that make me feel it's likely that the US deep state, the people who carried out 9/11, carried out a biological warfare attack on China last year in November, after the stock market collapsed behind the scenes in September, in order to mess up the Chinese economy. The Chinese have managed to deal with this pretty well.
Let's look at the political implications, though, because we're finding that lots of the people who are pro-lockdowns are also people who were Remainers in the Brexit business. In fact, it seems to be a frightening correlation. One of them is a chap who's saying, if you don't have a vaccine, you're not having a job. And he's the anti-Brexit Pimlico Plumbers boss, Charlie Mullins. He's introducing a no vaccine, no job policy, barring anybody who refuses a vaccination for what they are calling the Chinese coronavirus. He's allocating up to £1 million to inoculate his workforce. So he's not actually a doctor. So he's saying that if you don't get a vaccine, then you're not going to have a job. Well, the other thing, of course, that's starting to appear is that if you don't get a vaccine, or at least at the moment, it's just a negative PCR test, that you won't be able to travel. Now, it's all getting a little bit over the top.
Well, a minute ago, we were talking about global politics and what's happening in the confrontation between the deep state in the US and China. And then suddenly we're talking about Brexit. Now, as I understand it, that particular guy you mentioned was pro-Brexit. He wasn't a Remainer at all. And he's saying that his people have got to have vaccines. Now, you know, in other words, it's like a Venn diagram. You know, people can be pro-Remain or pro-Brexit and pro or anti-vaccine, and the intersection set may is going to be whatever it is. But you and there clearly is, if you look at the Tory party in this country, a big overlap between those who are against lockdowns and who are pro-Brexit, and vice versa. A lot of pro-Remain people tend to be in favour of lockdown. But don't forget that in the countries which have actually dealt with the virus, like Taiwan and New Zealand, there is no lockdown. Everybody's going about their business.
Look,
and the economy's,
I mean, you've got to get
up
your facts straight, Martin, on Charlie Mullins. He was most definitely not pro-Brexit.
Okay, well,
he was initially, I don't know why you're saying these things.
Well, I don't know, I just remember that
just
he was.
You just didn't know. But anyway, he was never
okay.
Pro-Brexit.
Okay, so
can we just explain to listeners what he was and how we know that? Well, he financially supported the Lib Dems in their supporting their campaign to prevent Brexit way back in 2017. So, you know, well, I say way back, that was just a year after the it's obviously he's decided, like Boris, maybe, you know, that he's just made, and who knows whether he's got any principles at stake. He may just feel that he's got to do it for other reasons, for political reasons, but he certainly wasn't you know, pro-Brexit. Anyway, let's get off of this because we need to cover some more of the stories, you know, to do with local and international stuff that aren't to do with. Because we're going to be hearing after the break, we're going to be hearing from a lot of doctors about various specific things to do with COVID-19 and some amazing information about the censorship of the doctors. It's incredible. I find it incredible that somebody would want to actually censor what a doctor has to say, even though it could have life-saving possibilities. It's almost like this doctor business is being used to actually destroy journalism in the Western world, and possibly it's being the similar thing is happening over in the East, in China, etc. too. What about, Martin, what about interest rates? I was reading in The Guardian this week that we might have a negative interest rate here in Britain. Silvana Tenreo, she's on the board of the Bank of England. I'm not sure who she is, but anyway, she says negative interest rates have worked elsewhere and would help the UK recovery from the COVID slump. Now, is she in a fantasy world? Could negative interest rates really help?
Well, they could certainly happen because other countries in the world, like Switzerland, for example, have had them for some time. The governor of the Bank of England has been a bit more cautious about it because the problem with negative interest rates is it undermines the profitability of retail banking. So there's no easy solution. I mean, it is extraordinary that in 2008 we had a credit crunch, and here we are in 2021 and we've still got ongoing quantitative easing and talk of negative interest rates. None of this is in the official textbooks which people are taught at university about how economics works. So we've got used to the idea that capitalism is somehow still existing because, you know, the shops when there's no lockdown are open and, you know, house prices are rising and stock markets are at the highest level they've ever been. And the obvious reason for that is they've basically been printing money hand over fist for all those years. And ultimately, I don't think there's much dispute among serious economists, whether left wing or right wing. Eventually, this is going to blow up like a great big bomb in everybody's faces. Capitalism is already finished. All that's keeping it afloat is money printing. That's it.
And asset price, but that's right. Yeah, but money printing is quite a powerful tool, isn't it? If you have the printing press, you can print as much money as you want. You can, if you want, you can give somebody a special, I don't know, like Illuminati credit card, and they can go spending as much as they want. They can buy yachts, houses and whatever, and they never have to pay it back. That's actually how this stuff really works, is that you've literally got the ability to create money out of nowhere, and you can give it to your friends, and if they don't pay you back, you can just tear up the receipt and say, never mind. Or, you know, you can lend it out at interest and charge exorbitant amounts. Now, money, in a way, you can see why it's almost like a religion, is some people realise that money is the way to control everything around them, control people, you know, buy court cases and this sort of thing.
Well, that's true. But the problem is that this parasitic political economy that's developed through money printing, QE and all the rest of it, actually is parasitic. The real economy is actually on its uppers as the stock markets of the world reach unprecedented heights. I mean, if people can't see what's wrong with that, then they can't understand what's going to happen next. There is going to be a massive crash at some point, and it'll happen either before or during or immediately after the declaration, you know, where the real fighting starts in World War III, which brings us back to what we were talking about earlier about biological warfare attacks on China as a result. And of course, the other thing that's happened, we were talking about legal things earlier, a court in Iraq has sentenced Donald Trump, has a call for the arrest of Donald Trump in relation to the assassination of the militia leader that was murdered at the same time as Soleimani this time last year. So the whole world, if we didn't have the COVID distraction, if you like, we'd all be saying, are we on the brink of World War III? Is the banking system going to collapse? But because we've got the COVID distraction, we're not even paying attention to the other more fundamental things, because nuclear weapons will kill us far faster than climate change and certainly faster than COVID.
Well, maybe if they're used. I mean, it seems to me nuclear weapons mostly seem to be being used, and maybe in the future, as ways of threatening and intimidating, like a sort of massive mafia tool rather than anything else. But anyway, Martin, end of this month, we've got, in fact, 25th to the 28th or 29th of January 2021, we've got something called the Davos Agenda, the World Economic Forum, the Great Reset happening, a big meeting up in the snowy peaked tops of the Alps in Switzerland. What do you think is going to come out of that? Because as all eyes have been set on that, with Klaus Schwab, the guy in charge, essentially running what is now, since, was it, I think, August, July last year, the effective merger with the United Nations, doing a lot of the financing for the UN now from Davos, a kind of privatized version of the UN. So it's becoming the big, big meeting. This is taking place in a week or so's time.
Well, the Great Reset is a kind of wish list by the top capitalists within that network of privilege which Davos represents. But of course, there are overlapping organizations like Bilderberg, the Council on Foreign Relations. There isn't just Davos. Davos is what, you know, Davos is a public forum, or at least, you know, it happens in public. A lot of this discussion will be going on behind closed doors, and we don't really know what they're plotting. And of course, what they're trying to present is that what they're calling the Great Reset, which means, you know, all power to big tech companies and the financial bank elite in the West, is the solution for climate change, the solution for inequality, the solution for all of society's ills. And it's just basically, it's capitalist wish fulfillment. And it's presented to the world as if it's some kind of benevolent force, when of course it isn't. It's just the same old people, basically pushing the same old agenda, but pretending.
It's a bit more than that this year, isn't it?
Rid of inequality, for example, which they're not.
It's a bit more than that this year. In fact, quite a lot more, because they seem to have the bit between their teeth with the idea of basically moving away from the traditional forms of financial regulation and into this whole idea of having a great reset, away from things like cash and towards the cashless society. There's enormous amount of pressure for that going on too. So is it feasible that the Great Reset might end up being taking kind of weight off of our backs?
No, it's not. The Great Reset is what they would like to do if they had the power. The reality is that there could quite easily be a crash in the financial system, which will, they're basically saying the financial system is secure despite everything, and we want to move to a cashless society and all the things that you're suggesting. But the problem with capitalism is it's not actually a stable system. It's an inherently unstable system. So their pretense that this is that we've got a stable system that needs to be reformed in various directions, and of course they make loads of noises about the environment and about poverty, but of course that's not really what it's about. It's about them and getting what they want and dominating the planet, which of course they're not necessarily going to succeed in doing, because reality, in fact, is a lot more unbiddable both for them and for us. I mean, for the ordinary people, it's very difficult to try and change the direction of events, and it's a huge struggle. Look at what's going on in Latin America, the massive, face-off between the popular forces and the forces of reaction, which has been going on for decades, but is very sharp at the moment. But they can't get all they want either. I mean, a country like the US has been unable to overthrow the Maduro government in Venezuela. They've been unable to overthrow the government of Cuba since 1959. They can't really do much about the Chinese taking over the whole of the developing world, certainly in Southeast Asia. The Chinese have just signed free trade agreements with virtually all of their neighbours apart from India, and the US has been excluded from that. And therefore, the battle isn't over, and they're not necessarily going to win.
Finally, before we have some music and before we have a second part where we'll be looking at COVID more closely and hearing from lots of doctors around the Western world, Martin, there is this accusation about somebody called, he's an Italian lawyer. A lawyer for Leonardo is a contractor who witnessed a US election interference operation, but in Italy. His name is Professor Alfio D'Urso. He's the lawyer for the man who claims to have witnessed an operation to interfere with the US elections in Italy on election night. He has released a video detailing his sworn affidavit. It's delivered to members of the US Congress Wednesday last week. Remarkably, the vote to certify the election results, it went forward. Well, it's not that remarkable, really, because this is the guy is Arturo Delia, D'Elia. What do you make of this? Do you think it's just a whole load of crazy QAnon stuff, or is there any truth to it?
Well, I have been following this. Well, first of all, the main point to make that you made earlier is if the election has been stolen, inverted commas, it certainly hasn't been stolen by Maduro and the Chinese communists. It's been stolen by the CIA, just as the 9/11 attack wasn't carried out by the Chinese communists either. Secondly, if what's gone on is the hacking of the Dominion voting machines in the swing states. So nobody on the Trump side is saying we won the election in terms of winning more votes than Biden. It's quite clear that there's been quite a lot of the Democrats have done very well in Georgia, for example. They've massively increased their vote because the demographics in the US are against the Republican Party. They're basically a party of old white men, and that is not
I just want to detail some of the allegations.
Yes, I'm coming to that, Tony.
D'Urso D'Elia. I'll do my bit, and then you can add what, if I miss bits and pieces out. So what he's saying is that he took part in an operation. This is Arturo D'Elia, which operatives from various intelligence agencies remotely manipulated votes from several locations in Italy, including the US embassy in Rome. They used military satellites owned and operated by Italian defense contractor Leonardo SPA to do it. The revelations are being brought to light with the help of Maria Zach, chairwoman of the nationalsinaction.org, nationalsinaction1word.org, a government accountability advocacy group based in Florida. Zach reportedly has received intercepts, photos and records of phone calls from the Italian intelligence service helping to bring the allegations to light. D'Elia says he's willing to testify to any individual and entity who participated in the scheme and allegedly involved the switching of votes from Donald Trump to Joe Biden on election night. Significantly, he says he's made data backups of the original data and the data after the switches the operatives were instructed to make, and is willing to provide that evidence in court. Whoever's reported this, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, said they've approached the Democratic Party and they haven't had a reply. Well, if this is a load of nonsense, then of course they wouldn't get a reply. But Martin, do you think there's anything to it or not? Is this just complete nonsense, or it may be feasible?
Well, to slightly change that around, Dominion Corporation, which provided the electronic voting machines which supposedly were hacked, they are suing Giuliani and Trump for $1.3 million So that will come to court as a civil case, and we will find what actually went on. I don't see why you should use electronic
votes. Well, this is Martin, presumably that is for damage to their reputation from Trump saying things about them fixing the elections and that their voting systems are unsafe.
Yes. So in other words, this is going to end up in court one way or another, because the Dominion Voting Corporation are going to take them to court for saying this. The point I was trying to make before you made your contribution is that even if there was manipulation of the electronic voting machines, and I think using electronic voting machines everybody presumes that they're hackable. That's why you should use paper ballots, because it's much more difficult to steal an election with paper ballots. But even if it came to the case that they were manipulated, all that they've done is flipped the vote in the swing states. But Joe Biden got 7 million more votes than Donald Trump. In any European country, not in our country, of course, because we've got a first-past-the-post system like the US has. In Russia, for example, you couldn't steal the election in that way. The Electoral College was originally designed in the 18th century to make sure that one vote wasn't one vote, that wealthier people would have more of a say than poorer people. The same with the Senate. But even with all that manipulation, the Democrats are now in control of both the White House, the Senate, and the Congress. And the system is rigged against them. So if the system is rigged against them and they've still managed to win all three branches of government, that suggests that even if Trump was to prove that there was some cheating, he could try and argue it in terms of US law. But in terms of world public opinion, he lost. He lost. He got less votes. He got less votes last time, 3 million less votes than Hillary Clinton. Say, well, it doesn't matter, that's the American system. And the Chinese just turn around and say, yeah, but it doesn't matter that we don't have open elections in China, that's just our system. The world public opinion judges on who got the most votes, not what the American Constitution written by white guys 200 years ago says. And that's the world we're in, because that kind of argument is what World War III is going to be all about.
Well, it was written by Freemasons who wanted to make sure that the property classes controlled everything in the
Absolutely.
United States.
It's a rigged system. Basically it was originally designed to make sure that although we're going to allow the hoi polloi to have some kind of a say, we've got to make sure that they don't have a veto on the property classes.
They created their new world for their new world order. Okay, so, well, thanks, Martin. We will have a break now for a few minutes, and we're going to hear some music, as we did last week, actually, from the Bristol's half-brother Surplus, who is alleged to have committed suicide around the time that the bigger lockdown was announced at the end of November. I think it was tier 3 here in Bristol. He's a musician. Very sad to see him go. There's been very little in the way of tributes I've seen around, other than some amazing murals around the city painted by artists in his honour. So we're going to hear now a couple of songs, which one of which is Surplus's own song, another one which he features in. So the first one is called Where I'm From, and the second one is with King Aggie on the line.
Bringing you the truth in the form of hip hop.
See, you thought I was finished. You thought I was down, but you didn't know that I'd be coming right back around just to finish what I started. But tease, I've parted just to get to where I'm going. Leave the dearly departed. I farted out better beats, what you call a rap. Hip hop's a damn busted. Now I'm closing the gap. I got an app sack full of fat tracks. Check your rap, that's good fellas on the mic. Fuck you up like Billy Bats. I don't imitate, I innovate. Fresh off the dinner plate. Cannibalistic on the mic. I have me a dinner date. With fake, no, I won't be late. Up and dope, doing this. Fucking fresh at the gate. Obviously they gon' hate. Shit, what you expect? That's like seeing naked chicks without getting a wreck. This is my intro, so I come correct, bro. But I hit the weed till I go and get a chest blow.
Spin it, digest, grab. That murder, kill, death, rap. I play with the best lap. I grip the west rap. Ever tap the back. Beating on eardrums. Hear it, it's fearsome. My period is piercing. Fierce and it's strong. Your crew is fearless and storms on the rap game. Lead to the surplus. Lyrics catch flame.
Hip
suffer from is so lonely. It's called hip hop, believe it never died. It's called hip hop, we're keeping it alive. This is where I'm from, you never know me. This is where I'm from, is so lonely. It's called hip hop, believe it never died. It's called hip hop, we're keeping it alive.
This is hip hop.
Pieces of pieces increases, rhyme reaches the teachers, the leeches who try to beat through other speeches and cream. I'm fucking living the dream, scraping the shit from the bottom while we're getting the cream. I got the blue moon glint in my eye today. I'm a bad boy, what the fuck you want me to say? Make no bones about it, strictly out for the cash. Chris Webby's profile, interviews with Dame Dash. Recognize my skills, I got a pair of fucking gills. I can spit it all day, what's he keeping it ill? So kiss me, thrill me, hold me. I was foretold, she graduated before you even enrolled me. So listen in, here we go. I'm empirical, ethereal, typical, lyrical, miracle. We telekinetic, kinetic, synthetic, genetics. Not pathetic, we frenetic, neurotic, and prophetic. This is where I'm from, you never know me. This is where I'm from, it's so lonely. It's called hip hop, believe it never died. It's called hip hop, we keeping it alive. This is where I'm from, you never know me. This is where I'm from, it's so lonely. It's called hip hop, believe it never died. It's called hip hop, we keeping it alive.
This is hip hop. This is hip hop.
So what do you hear? What do you say? Calling my shit gay? Just to wonder what the fuck is a radio play? From nervous breakdowns to prescription pills, didn't spend for 5 years till I lost the skills. But I couldn't stop writing, now the pen won't let me. Yo, thinking to myself, is the world gon' get me? I'm real about my shit, I'm not here to pretend. Cause we're all gonna die when it comes to the end. Could you better me? Well, not very cleverly. Even if I die tomorrow, I'd still be doper than you'd ever be. Given a choice, God gave me a voice. Then tell my story, lift you up like a flag, a hoist. So I keep on moving, you're demanding a show. As I continue with every sinew to command flow.
This is hip hop.
This is where I'm from, you never know me. This is where I'm from, it's so lonely. It's called hip hop, believe it never died. It's called hip hop, we're keeping it alive. This is where I'm from, you never know me. This is where I'm from, it's so lonely. It's called hip hop, believe it never died. It's called hip hop, we're keeping it alive. This is where I'm from, you never know me. This is where I'm from, it's so lonely. It's so lonely. It's called hip hop, believe it never died. It's called hip hop, we're keeping it alive.
He's against the drugs thing, right? Because you see, from my wife gone, and me's alone for so long.
Selling
they
drugs
tell me
on
to
the dime. Hanging out young thugs that all carry knives.
Hear what now?
Selling drugs on the dime. Hanging out.
I go buy some drugs from a drug dealer.
I just
right?
Sell drugs on the line.
When them hide the drugs, it's not the right thing.
I just sell drugs on the line.
On the people care. Like me see them enough. Man, what
sell drugs on the dime?
I for them. I don't carry knives. Looking at them better.
I just sell drugs on the dime.
Watch them.
I came down with Bobby Brown, Whitney with me and Charlie them. No stopping it, popping it, chopping it off. You want something soft by your big Bob Marley them. Even sticks for the Marley them. If anything, nigga call me then. I got everything. Money ting, anything, gunny ting. No funny thing, nigga call me then. Old school like Atari them. Stick to the rules of the jungle and safari them. New school like Shamari them. Crash the whip, flip by a brand new Ferrari. Them. Keep it ugly like Ciari them. Money drugs are the thing where you get from the army then. Don't pay your money for me then. Don't pay your money for me, calmly come a cause them. Ah. I used to sell drugs on the line.
Hanging out with your thugs that all carry knives.
I said, I used to sell drugs on the line.
Hanging out with your thugs that all carry knives.
I used to sell drugs all the time.
Hanging out with your thugs that all carry knives.
I used to sell drugs all the time.
Hanging out with your thugs that all carry knives.
King gave me the call, so it's time to go to work. Still trying to live a clean life, but I'm known to dirt. So I can get you food in the ends, food in the ends. We ain't gotta go to birds. Think about what I said, like I chose my words. I can tell you about the roads, yeah, I know the curbs. I've been about old school, I used to roll with gerbs. Urban days, finding war was the turf. Not a lot changed, in fact it probably got worse. I don't mean the weather around here, it's getting hotter. I was real lucky last time that I got searched. You should have seen the face of the officer when he couldn't find the thing, fam, he got hurt. Slid it to the chick, they ain't gonna stop her. I used to be the teacher. I said I used to be a teacher, so how could I not learn?
I used to sell drugs on the line,
hanging out with you thugs that all carry nines.
I said I used to sell drugs on the line,
hanging out with you thugs that all carry nines.
I used to sell drugs all the time,
hanging out with you thugs that all carry nines.
I used to sell drugs all the time,
hanging out with you thugs that all carry nines.
Yo, all of they got them. Keep me round the back of where they flat them. The whole place looking just like I crap them. If on the lake shots, we have to clap them. All ring and big 4-5, they match them. Man, I stack them. 2 strike more, we could have matched them. I spend bare time sitting down and back them. 0.47, men I got black them. I was shot way before Melly and such them. Way before Dagger was one of the madmen. King give me a thing, it was on a run them. Swap bars and grabs for grabs them. Collecting money, the gully way is the plan, friend. If you're not making your money, big up your mans them. If you're not holding no money, you know your hand, friend. Times money ain't nothing funny, you're fucking rampant.
I used to sell drugs on the line,
hanging out with you thugs that all carry knives.
I said, I used to sell drugs on the line,
hanging out with you thugs that all carry knives.
I used to sell drugs all the time,
hanging out with you thugs that all carry knives.
I used to sell drugs all the time,
hanging out with you thugs that all carry knives.
Okay, so that's Surplus there, speaking to us from the other side. Bristol musician, half-brother of the Bristol's rather Tony Blairite-like mayor, Marvin Rees, who passed away at the end of November. He's a musician. The allegation, anyway, is that he committed suicide, and many of people who have lost their livelihoods are feeling very bad at the moment, suicidal, in fact. And we've seen so many, haven't we? People who've made their entire lives, their plans around what they're going to do in the future, and they're just being told now, nope, you can't do that. You've got no income. You've got no stake in the economy anymore. Cheerio. So people are having to basically fight like rats in a sack to survive. And I'm joined now by Dr. David Halpin from Devon. David, nice to have a chat with you. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you, Tony, very well.
Can you tell us what you make of this psychological effect of this thing that's been going on? Because, we don't want to talk specifically about this particular case of the musician here in Bristol, Surplus. His name's Martin Walker, who was the mayor's half brother, who it looks as if certainly the allegations are that he committed suicide at the end of November. But there are many, many people now feeling terrible strain due to all these measures, and also, of course, the complete uncertainty about any way out of this.
Well, Tony, I use the word cataclysm when I spoke with you in March when you were in New Zealand. It is a cataclysm. It is the worst thing that's happened to our global humanity ever. It's destroying minds, having destroyed livelihoods. There's great anxiety in many people. Many people are obedient and gullible, and those people are going with the drift, so to speak, not in lockstep, but just doing what they're told. And they, of course, are helping the process along. I do take some hope, and I feel that we're winning actually in the last few days for several reasons. But when I speak to people who are down the bottom, often on probably on 0 hours contracts, people in the agricultural merchants, the big plant nursery near here, Plant Galore, whose boss stood up against the socialist Exeter City Council very early on. They sent him three closure notices, one after the other. He tore one up in succession. And the third one he tore up on the ghastly BBC Spotlight programme, saying that what's going on, I'm paraphrasing, of course, down the road, just down the road, a few hundred yards away, there was a Sainsbury's selling plants, but he was being closed down when all he was doing was selling plants. So he tore it up, and he didn't obey the order, and he went on trading. And I spoke to some of his employees, they were jubilant, and I noticed that when I speak to the people, what I call the common man and woman, not the middle classes, who are fairly useless in their complacency, they light up. They're so pleased to find someone who's fluent and who knows his stuff as a well-trained doctor speaking about this incredible lie. It's just extraordinary. The BBC is going full guns. I just watch it occasionally. My wife watches it quite often, sadly, and she has a cognitive dissonance, which is so common. I'm sorry for her. She knows what I think, and I'm being blunt about it. But there's an obedience in so many, which she shares. And we've just had today, she's been offered the COVID-19 vaccination. They haven't told her which one of the three she's being offered, but she did initially accept two appointments for the first and second shot in April. She has now, in fact, decided to cancel those because I raised my voice, in fact, rather strongly. I was so sad to see my wife of 59 years being browbeaten because she's an innocent, lovely person, and she's obedient. She probably has a rather dominant husband, I know that. But I have to be dominant to try and get across to people the wickedness. It is wicked beyond belief. And I've been fighting with you, Tony, and with about 30 other people online. We've done everything we can to tell people. I've written to the BBC. There's about three or four letters to Pym, the chief health correspondent, son of a GP, who trots out the propaganda every ruddy night. He looks so honest, and yet he isn't. He's always saying, thank you very much, Hugh Edwards says, thank you, Hugh, thank you, Hugh, thank you, Hugh. You switch on the BBC, all you hear is a word. Within a minute, you'll hear the words lockdown, first used in prison riots in America. You hear COVID, you hear cases, and you hear infections. And all the time they're conflating the useless flipper coin RT-PCR test with disease. That's the essential lie that they've promoted. Now, of course, they're pushing the variant COVID-19. It is beyond belief. The gullibility is shocking. The obedience is shocking. What I call the ductility, metallurgical word, is shocking. But the people down the bottom who have to use their brains and their hands, often in menial jobs, but they're thinking as well, I notice. They know what's going on. And the turning round is coming fairly shortly.
Okay, David, can I just ask you, I know it's a bit of a cheeky thing to ask, but without raising your voice, what did you use to persuade your wife that maybe, you shouldn't be... having a vaccine, because that's quite, it's contrary to a lot of the advice that we're getting, isn't it?
Of course it is. No, the thing is, I did raise my voice because my frustration is absolute. Sue knows how much I've tried. She doesn't read all my emails, but she knows I've sent letters to the MP. I've just sent, yesterday, I've addressed Pym, the health correspondent, whose father's a GP, as I said. I included Hancock, his MP address. I included Priti Patel. And tomorrow, if Pym doesn't change his tone, I'm going to write specifically to Patel, to Hancock, and to Johnson. And I'll say this. This is very important, Tony. People are believing criminals. Criminals. Johnson, in 2013, when he was touring the Middle East, no doubt visiting Israel, as foreign secretary, he said that Britain was about toppling Assad. That is in contravention of the Charter of the United Nations and several other international laws. It is a criminal offence. He should be brought to the bar now. with Mr. Blair alongside. He also then gave £90 million of our taxes to the so-called rebels, whose names transmuted weekly, but who were shelling civilian areas. I've got still shots of that, using gas canisters. Extraordinary what was going on, and decapitating people. They even decapitated a 13-year-old boy who refused to serve coffee to one of the so-called rebels in a souk in Damascus, in a Damascus suburb. We're dealing with elemental evil. It is wall to wall. Patel, when she was, I think, in some defense, I can't remember what particular title she had then, this fascist woman of Indian extraction, but she regards herself as a British citizen. She visited Israel 3 years ago, I think it was. She had meetings with the Israeli Defense Force, better called Israeli Occupation Force, and she was keen on giving British support, our money, to field hospitals run by the Israelis in the Golan Heights. The Golan Heights, as you know, is occupied territory, Israel having won it in 1973, I think, from Syria. They're still there as a cuckoo in the Golan nest. Mr. Hancock, I understand, gave out a contract to a publican in his village who contacted Hancock on the WhatsApp about getting a contract for so-called the useless PPE. And that chap, I think, without any capital or very little capital and no knowledge of the perspex or gauze or whatever, got a contract ain't worth millions. These people are criminals. And they will be brought to book eventually, even though they've managed to trash our justice system as well.
But can I just ask you specifically, as a doctor, what it is that you would advise your patients not to have the vaccine? Why you would?
Well, first of all, it's not necessary. The video that you sent round, from which was wonderful, Dr. Simone Gold, it raised my spirits. A lovely doctor. She's also, in fact, she's attractive and helps as well, but she's fluent, highly intelligent, and she knows her stuff. She looks after people in the ERs in America. She's been sacked from her two posts by the medical directors because she was outspoken about the value of hydroxychloroquine in people with this syndrome. It's a strange thing. The virus hasn't been isolated, and yet there is a syndrome. Syndrome means a collection of symptoms, what people say, and signs, what the doctor sees in the patient. One of the consistent factors is the persistent dry cough. That's been around before.
Hang on a minute. I mean, the virus has been isolated. It was isolated by the Chinese back in January last year, a year ago.
Not in the information I have.
I know. So there's a lot of disinformation about this.
Disinformation as well.
That is because in the UK, they don't want anybody delving into this genome and looking very closely at this virus, because they might find that it's been deliberately man-made and engineered.
Well, all the circumstantial evidence is strong that it's an engineered virus. And it may be that in the engineering, they managed, in fact, to blur or even blunt some characteristics which normally allow viruses to be the Cox, Robert Cox postulate, I think it was 1856. He was affected by wonderful men like Pasteur. They were remarkable people. His four postulates, they haven't met one postulate. One is that it should be, and if you take it to animals, you can see disease in the animal. Another one, you should be able to transfer it from human to human. I can't remember immediately the four postulates, but not one is met.
Well, I mean, I've caught it off of my wife, so I mean that's.
Well, there you are. There's no question. Some of my colleagues have been very keen on saying there's no virus. I've been very careful about that, because if it plays into the hands of those people who call us conspiracists.
Well, yes, it certainly does.
I say there's a syndrome. There's a syndrome, because decent people like this doctor who you showed today, Simone Gold, she's seen it in her ERs, and she's also seen people recovering quickly with hydroxychloroquine or with ivermectin. So she's seen it. She's a very nice, she's got a Jewish name, don't care about that. She's She's a very good doctor, I can see that.
Okay, since you've brought her up, David, I think it would be nice to have a listen to her, because we've got a clip from her, around about 5 minutes, explaining what happened to her, because one of the most shocking things about Simone Gold is that once she started saving people's lives in the hospital in which she worked, she got a phone call from her boss telling her not, which is absolutely unbelievable. It does rather, it's a bit like a smoking gun, really. Something's obviously very wrong. So the reason for that...
Can I interject quickly?
Yeah.
One of my colleagues in FRCS, a good consultant surgeon, ex-India, Mohammed Adil, he was deregistered in a kangaroo court, i.e. the General Medical Council, right at the beginning of this, because he went into Trafalgar Square, and he expressed the main thing which was motivating him to speak out against this scam, this pandemic, was that people's livelihoods were being ruined. This is a man of the people. It's his second language, yet he spoke out, and I salute him. I salute this man. Within a few weeks, he was off the register. What?
Well, I mean, luckily, I know it's appalling, but Simone Gold is still on the register in the United States and most very, very active. Anyway, let's have a listen to her now, explaining what happened to her.
Right.
All of a sudden, we started hearing as doctors, even as doctors, that hydroxychloroquine was unsafe. You can't understand what's going on with the lies until you understand what an enormous lie this is. Hydroxychloroquine is over-the-counter in much of the world. Okay, it's taken in many African nations. They call it Sunday medicine because you take it every Sunday, right? That's like its name, Sunday. People keep it in their pocket the way Americans might keep a Tylenol in their purse. It's absolutely ordinary stuff. It was over the counter, really, in any country which had malaria or any country that had citizens that would visit malaria countries on holiday. It was over the counter. For example, it was over the counter in France. The only reason it wasn't over the counter in America is there just wasn't a consumer demand. Right? In America, we use hydroxychloroquine for two main reasons. That's lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, and also for malaria for people going on holiday. But generally, it's lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. And for those illnesses, patients regularly see physicians so they can get a prescription for it. That's why it was never over-the-counter here. Not because it was unsafe. It's been FDA approved for 65 years. We give it to babies. We give it to children. We give it to pregnant women. We give it to nursing mothers. We give it to the elderly, and we give it to the immune compromised. Those last two categories take this medication for decades. There was never a pretense that it's not safe. That's the drug that you've been hearing about for 9 months now, 10 months, telling you it's unsafe. It's an incredible lie of incredible proportions. Once you understand that, you will be suspicious of everything that follows. So that's where I found myself. There I was in the emergency department, treating patients as they came in with COVID-19. And once we had the rapid test so I can confirm the diagnosis, my first patient, who I needed to give hydroxychloroquine and zinc to, I did it, and even knowing the kind of the controversy, I really didn't think twice about it. I don't know. It was fine. I gave it to her. I actually called her the next day. She was so much better. She herself got better within about 12 hours. In about 48 hours, she was essentially completely well. This completely matched what I had read in the scientific literature. I knew many doctors who had done this. I'd read many journal articles. It was completely consistent. What was really shocking and completely inconsistent was my medical director, who calls me the next day and threatens to fire me for doing this treatment. I can't even tell you even as I describe this moment to you, it's shocking to me. I remember the case, the situation, the conversation, and he's saying he's going to fire me. And I said, why would you fire me over this? Well, I don't think it works. I said, well, then don't prescribe it. You know, you haven't read the science the way I have. I know it works. You'll change your mind in a couple of months when, you know, you get a little wiser. But why would you get involved with you know, me treating a patient? You do your thing. I do my thing. That's how medicine is practiced. We are licensed as individuals. It's actually against the law to have what's called a corporate practice of medicine where, you know, corporation practices for you. It has to be the individual doctor's physician. That's why patients go to multiple doctors, right? No. And really, almost the worst part of the conversation was not even that he was ignorant that the drug worked, but his reasons for saying that he was going to fire me if I did this. And the reason, which he put in writing because he wasn't so smart, he said it was because the biggest payer at that hospital, which is a large insurance company that everyone here has heard of, that's back on the West Coast mainly, didn't want us to prescribe it. They were blocking it. So that payer insurance company was pressuring the hospital that their doctor shouldn't do it. It had nothing to do with even if he thought it was good or bad for the patient. It all had to do with money and payment, which was, I honestly still can't believe I'm relating this story. It was really unbelievable. So he said, I could never do that again. I said, well, good luck with that. So it kept happening. It happened about 4 or 5 times. And I kind of knew that my days at that particular hospital were going to be numbered, right? I mean, how long is this going to last? So I started looking online for other physicians like myself. I knew I couldn't be the only one. And I found the most amazing group of doctors, really just brilliant, intelligent, compassionate, kind. And you know, we got together and we called ourselves the America's Frontline Doctors. And what I felt needed to happen was we needed to break this disinformation cycle to which the Americans were all being subjected to, and people across the world as well. So I set up to do something called the White Coat Summit, which was an entire day of education. We brought doctors and we brought social media influencers. Young people know them as YouTubers. So we brought a whole bunch of YouTubers and a whole bunch of doctors. We brought to Washington. We did 7 hours of education. And we laid out all the facts, you know, very dispassionate. Here's the facts on hydroxychloroquine. Here's the facts on lockdowns. Here's the facts on masks. Here's the facts on, you know, schools and kids transmission. Here's the facts for the elderly. Here's the facts on, you know, other treatments other than hydroxychloroquine. And we did that. In the middle of that day, we took a break and we walked over to the Supreme Court. And that was the video that got 20 million views. It gets 20 million views, not because I can sing like Beyonce, but because human beings recognize truth. We have something inside of us, right?
So, David, I'd imagine that's something you concur with.
I thought that everything she said was based in fact. And I also found she was measured too. When she concluded her 42 minutes, she spoke of the various cohorts, the various ages, how they would advise people about the vaccine. She did that in a very measured way. I thought she was excellent in every way, and I almost weep, in fact, to find a colleague like her, because I'm afraid that the medical profession in this country is reaching its nadir, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I've got some good news for you, because I think it's probably only fair to hear from Martin, if Martin has got any comments on what he heard from yourself and Dr. Gold. But I want to go in a minute to listen to some UK doctors talking about the various other, what they basically say are cures in many ways for this. So we're talking about mainly about chloroquine and ivermectin, both of which have got extraordinary effects, particularly when they're used at the early stages of COVID-19. And yet, as we just heard there, you've got pen pushers within hospitals who are actually physically, well, you know, threatening people, stopping doctors using what they believe is the best treatment, and then sacking them when they take them on. But Martin, what do you make of what you heard from Simone Gold and from David?
The question of whether the how drugs are allowed to be used or not used is a big issue. I don't feel qualified to argue with any doctors saying anything about these things. But as an economist, the question of what gets allowed to be used and what doesn't get allowed to be used, the systems are in place and those systems are clearly flawed. And there's an awful lot of regulatory capture. So as I understand, the main argument about hydroxychloroquine is that it's basically a cheap generic alternative to vaccination and so on. But of course, what the pharmaceutical companies want to do is the most expensive option. It's a bit like the Royal Navy. When they're asked, what do you want? They say, well, we want the most expensive stuff. And so there's always a pressure to produce, you know, to do stuff which is expensive. I mean, the Pfizer vaccine is about, I believe, around $30 a shot, and of course the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is also being marketed at the moment, is around $2 or $3 a shot. And of course the two vaccines have been developed in Cuba, and they're going to be issued for free to the Cuban population, and in Argentina they've decided to go with the Russian vaccine. So there isn't just one vaccine out there. And, of course, there may be quite possibly cheaper alternatives to vaccination which are being suppressed. But that is quite different from saying, A, that COVID-19 doesn't exist, B, that it might be man-made, and if it's man-made, who made it and for what purpose? Those are wider questions.
Yeah, it seems incredible that it should be used as a sort of massive profit opportunity. But anyway, it's not just in the United States doctors are saying this sort of thing. We're going to hear from two doctors now, both part of the same group here in the UK and in the US. I believe they're working with US doctors too. And one of them, if you were in the island of Guernsey and you happened to have an accident and you were taken to the Princess Elizabeth Hospital there, in an accident emergency, Dr. Scott Mitchell is one of those doctors that may well be the first person to find you and treat you. And I had a chat to him yesterday about all of this, and he is really simply looking at specifically at ivermectin. Again, like chloroquine, it's an antiparasitic drug, but it seems to have an enormous effect. And we'll be hearing a bit more in a minute about exactly what that effect is. But let's have a listen, first of all, to about 5 minutes, maybe a bit less, from Dr. Scott Mitchell now, I spoke to yesterday.
Ivermectin is the... I say it's kind of been hiding below the radar for a while. It's not been advocated by Trump or anyone like that. But just there's just, as I said before, there's more and more studies coming out suggesting it really does work.
Okay, so why is it that something that's designed to kill off a parasite, you know, maybe a worming drug, can be effective in the case of a virus, which is actually a completely different part of the body? It's in the nose and the respiratory area rather than in the gut, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's interesting. We have drugs that work for various conditions already. You know, I could give you one drug that was, say, developed for angina, hypertension, high blood pressure, which was Viagra, that is actually used largely for a completely different indication, mainly nowadays. But as I say, drugs can work in different ways, and it appears the pharmacology of action is probably multifactorial for ivermectin. It seems you've probably heard of the virus has got these spike proteins on its surface, which allows it to enter cells through the ACE2 receptor. It seems that ivermectin can bond to these spike proteins and prevent it entering cells. And there's also some suggestion that if the virus does get into the cell, it can inhibit transporting proteins into the nucleus of the cell as well. So we think it's multifactorial. It's very interesting. And as well, in the later stages, once there's not many virus, but we think there's probably an anti-inflammatory action of ivermectin. So it's quite amazing, really, that this drug is just sort of come out of, well, not quite nowhere, but from a drug that's been around for ages, used for another purpose, and might be a saving grace in this pandemic.
Amazing. Well, I mean, I suppose the obvious question to ask is, how come this isn't like mainstream news and all places around the world which are treating COVID patients are starting to at least trial it, particularly with early patients? We don't seem to be hearing anything about this. Why is that?
Yeah, well, there are places around the world that have been issuing this, I suppose, on the back of the earlier data. These are largely or mainly South American countries. And it was quite interesting to see when ivermectin was started distributed in some of these countries. And this was actually data we looked at, not just in young people, but people over 60 years old, that as soon as ivermectin or soon after ivermectin was distributed, the death rate started to plummet. And that's not just in one country, that's in several regions. And we've also seen the same in a region of India called Uttar Pradesh. I think it's the largest state in India. Now, there could be issues with underreporting of cases, but they've got a population of something like 230 million, and comparing that to the death rates in the UK for similar ratios of population.
Why is this drug finding its way into South America and India, but not to the UK?
To the UK? Well, it's trying to get the word out about there, and people aren't unfortunately, believing that in some cases that we've got enough data. I think as it stands, we've got randomized controlled trials on it from various different countries, Bangladesh, India, Iran, totally, if I can remember correctly, over 2,000 patients.
Scott Mitchell there.
Tony, the reason why we don't hear about it here is because the press is a servant to big pharmacy, the weapons industry, and government. That's the fact of it. People are told nothing. I've just been reading quite recently the book by David Cromwell and Edwards, Newspeak. It's a dramatically good book, written about 5 years ago. But it shows you all the mechanisms that the mainstream media in this country use to misinform people and to keep them away from the facts. Going back to the reason why Dr. Gold was sacked, there are two obvious motivations. One is that they want to see more deaths to scare people. The second thing is that in America, as you know, they were giving bounties to hospitals when they made a diagnosis of COVID-19. I think it was $9, I think. They got an extra bounty if they put on the respirator, which was found to be killing people, in fact. And they got an even bigger bounty when COVID-19 was added to the death certificate. And I'm told that in this country it's happening to a whistleblower who works in central government, not employed at the moment, has said that there is a bounty being given here if it's on the death certificate. The other day, in Torbay, a young woman came up to a very good friend of mine who's very active in this campaign to tell people the facts, and she said that her family were distressed and angry because the grandfather had died of a ruptured aneurysm in Torbay Hospital. I repeat, a ruptured aneurysm. It's a dramatic death, painful, and it can be, in fact, saved. But it's much better to do it cold when you know there's an aneurysm which might burst. They added COVID-19 to the death certificate, and they regarded it as taking his honour in vain, really. This is going on. At the same time, she said that a car rolled over on the seaside road in Torquay. They had to close the traffic because of this accident. But the story was that the driver had just had a C19 vaccination in the English Riviera Centre in the parkland in the middle of Torquay about 10 minutes before. There's been no facts published about it, nothing on so-called Devon Live, but that's what's going on.
Well, they've done their very best, haven't they, to keep quiet adverse reactions to the vaccine, yet some of them have leaked out.
I cannot. It is terrible.
Now I just want to go back to Scott Mitchell and what he was saying, because one of the things is a longer interview with him, which I'll leave up on our show page tonight, which is thisweek.org.uk, which is about a 40-minute interview altogether. One of the fascinating things he says, David, is that he's written, in fact, his group has written to Jeremy Farrar, who is on Sage, urgently demanding a reply to this research with over 2,000 people involved in various studies, proper double-blind studies, placebo studies, this kind of thing, about ivermectin, saying that, you know, they're talking about saving something like 3/4 of people who contract COVID's lives with this drug.
Yes.
And he cannot understand why after several months he's still not received a reply from Jeremy Farrar.
Yes, well, that would fit. They're all in lockstep. Whitty looks to me like a Manchurian candidate. Interesting, in fact, that his father, did you know this? His father was a cultural attaché in Athens when his car was blown up, along with two secretaries, I think. As you know, cultural attachés, all sorts of attachés, have other functions in our wonderful SIS.
Well, as Jeremy Farrar has other associations, he's been a long-time chair of the Wellcome Foundation.
Yes, I know that. I think, I recall that. But what I'm trying to say is that Whitty was one of four boys, all at Malvern College, his father working for... as a cultural attaché. We don't know what that involved, but just imagine that Whitty grew up in a family which, in fact, served, might not serve the truth. I'm being quite blunt about that. But when I look at Whitty, he looks to me if he's possessed. And I do not forget that Valance the chief scientific advisor, so-called, is said, I think it's true, that he has £600,000 of his shares still in Pfizer, which he was chief executive for the British version of Pfizer.
Fascinating. What we're seeing is a lot of
Walsh on BBC. His wife Bernadette, who was a GP, she's the chief executive for Smith, Kline and French in the Benelux countries.
Well, I mean, I think really what's going on here is you've got the big pharmaceutical companies have got so much wealth in their slush funds that they're basically now in a position to make policy rather like. Yes. The World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab and Prince Charles are in a position to make policy at the United Nations. Anyway, let's have a listen to one of his colleagues, Scott Mitchell's colleagues now, is Dr. Andrew Hill. He's up at Liverpool University, but he's also been looking deeply into the ivermectin studies, and he's come up with some absolutely incredible, what should be earth-shattering results with enormous numbers of people who are being given this as a treatment, recovering from COVID-19.
So we used Cochrane-Mantel-Heinzel testing with inverse variance weighting and random effects modelling to compare outcomes between ivermectin and control treatment. And we looked at effects of dose on response as well. What we first saw looking at viral clearance was faster viral clearance across the largest studies. So you can see in the large Egyptian study for the people with moderate infection or severe infection, a clearance time of 5 days versus 10 days for moderate, 6 days versus 12 days for severe, and in Bangladesh, using a slightly lower dose, 9.7 days versus 12.7 days. And the largest trials dominated the meta-analysis showing this conclusion. We then looked at hospital discharge. Faster time to hospital discharge was seen in the largest studies looking at the highest doses. And on this graph, On the left-hand side, you can see studies using higher doses moving to lower doses on the right-hand side. And we saw overall faster times to hospital discharge and a higher percentage of patients experiencing clinical recovery when taking ivermectin relative to control treatment. In this meta-analysis, you can see the percentage of patients achieving clinical recovery. And this is the clinical recovery was reported in different ways in different studies. But overall, there was a 43% higher chance of patients achieving clinical recovery on ivermectin versus control, with a confidence interval of 21 to 67%. We then looked at survival, and you can see here in the ivermectin arms of the studies, 8 out of 573 people died, 5%, versus in the control arms, 44 out of 507 people died, 17%. And looking at the meta-analysis, first of all, of the randomized trials, you can see this corresponds to an 83% reduction in the risk of dying for people taking ivermectin versus control, with confidence intervals of 65% to 92% improvements in survival. Then when we looked at the observational studies as supportive evidence, and those also showed a significant improvement in survival. So combining everything, there is a 72% improvement in survival for ivermectin versus control, with confidence intervals of 38 to 87%. Now, we looked then at dose response effects, because as you can see, there are many different doses and durations being looked at in these studies. The strongest treatment effects we saw in the Egyptian trial with 5 days of treatment using a 0.4 mg per kick dose. And the smallest effects were seen in an Iranian trial with 1 day of treatment using a 0.2 mg per kick dose. We also had data from randomized comparisons in Bangladesh, where people were given either 1 or 5 days of ivermectin. In Argentina, PK/PD correlations were analyzed, and those will be presented in a moment. So you can see in the Egyptian study, where the dose is highest, we see the strongest effects on either improvement in prognosis or hospital stays or the days where people were RT-PCR positive. That's true either looking at mild, moderate patients or severe patients. And then by contrast, the smallest treatment effects or treatment benefits were seen. They were still statistically significant, but they were smaller in terms of duration of low oxygen saturation, duration of hospital stay, and death rates.
Well, some pretty amazing figures there, David. We're talking, he's saying basically between 64 and 92% of people recovering, not dying, against the control experiment. And another one of the studies was 83%. Now, this is what we're looking at here is at least something like three quarters of the people that would have died after being treated with ivermectin didn't die.
Yes. Well, what is Andrew Hill's specialism? Is he on the line still?
No, he's at the University of Liverpool. I'm not sure what his specialism is, no.
Well, I've seen his name, in fact, in correspondence, actually. But the thing is that the people, as you know, Tony, have been speaking obvious truth, or likely truth, from the word go. People like Professor Ioannidis from Stanford University, people like Witkowski, other people, the ex-health minister of Israel was one of them, actually, but about 20 or plus on Off Guardian, where they kept the recordings, they were censored almost immediately.
I'll just tell you, he's a virologist.
Virologist, well, we listened to him very carefully. As I listened to the people who taught me at Mary's in the 1960s, early 60s, including a wonderful immunologist, Professor Ken Porter, who was later a Nobel Prize winner, and deserved that, in fact, in that case. But he taught us about immunology in detail. So when I hear Mr. Pym et al. On television telling us about the vaccine or whatever, these people are speaking, they're just given scripts. They know nothing about medicine. They know nothing about the human condition much, and they're prepared to ignore the most terrible injury to children in particular. Some of those children whose minds are being blanked, who are regressing in some cases, going back to nappies, I'm told, in some primary schools, some of those children will never recover from what's happening now. I regard it as evil beyond imagination, and I look forward to the time when the Witties and the Valances and the Johnsons and the Patels and the rest of them are brought to book. I forgot to add about Patel, I didn't have time, but the reason why she was what she did in Israel was against ministerial rules. She did not tell her department that she was having a confab with murderers in Israel. It was done secretly, and she should have been sacked on the spot, but of course she survives, and she has the confidence of another ace liar, our Prime Minister.
Okay, well, so Dr. Scott Mitchell and Dr. Andrew Hill seem to both be part of something called the FLDCCC, so I think that's the Frontline Doctors COVID Committee of some sort. Anyway, both of them, fascinating, I think, to listen to, and you can hear the full interviews up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But we're going to go, before we hear from Martin, we're going to go across the Atlantic now to, not to United States, but to Canada, to hear a chap called Dr. Stephen Malthouse. And to begin with, he's said, and it's I find it incredible listening to and watching this interview on Canadian television, because the interviewer is actually not being spiteful or trying to pick holes in that person's argument, but he's obviously interested in this as a new piece of information and giving him the time of day, which you would never get here in the UK. So well done, Alberta. Well done, Canada. And what he starts off by saying, Dr. Stephen Malthouse, is that there's no pandemic.
Well, you have to differentiate COVID cases, which are people that have positive PCR tests. And those could be completely healthy people without any symptoms. And a majority of them are like that. Those would be determined to be cases. Now, normally in medicine, a case is someone who's actually sick. Now, these aren't sick people. And when we look at hospitalizations and death and also ICU admissions, we see that there's been no change in the last year than what we've seen in previous years. So looking at all-cause mortality is the most important measurement. And the reason behind that is because the COVID diagnosis is based on a PCR test. This is where they take a swab from your nose and then they amplify it multiple times. Normally you would amplify that 25, maybe 30 times the maximum. It's a bit like taking a Xerox and then re-Xeroxing the Xerox and re-Xeroxing the Xerox in an attempt to actually identify and match up RNA, which is taken from that swab, with the RNA from coronavirus. Now, if you over-amplify that, which in Canada they're doing 33 to 45 times across the different provinces, then you will actually make everybody positive who's got any little bits of RNA in their nose, and it doesn't indicate that they're actually infective. these people cannot pass it on. So what you're doing is you're finding what we call cases, but these are not really sick people. So if you keep talking about cases on the news, everyone's going to be misled, and that's what's happened. So people are running around frightened of these cases. We call it a case-demic. But in fact, there are very few patients who have COVID at this time. So when we look at what happened in the spring and also what's happening right now, we see that the normal curves, the influx of patients, you know, some to the hospital, of course, but people getting sick, is what we would normally see at these times of the year. There's been no change.
Well, that's extraordinary, isn't it? And another thing, of course, there's been no change to is the fact that Britain's hospitals are overrun in January. But Dr. Stephen Malthouse goes on to talk about why he doesn't believe a vaccine is needed or necessary, and then also about the enormous amount of surveillance that's now being driven out. And this is originally a 20-minute interview on Canadian TV. We're going to hear about another 5 minutes of it now. Incredibly, they just allow this kind of stuff. We haven't heard anybody like this speaking on the British television whatsoever. Or I think it's probably true to say on the mainstream, you know, Operation Mockingbird media in the United States either. So these people are clearly being prevented from having their say and contributing to the debate, which is very, very sinister. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Dr. Stephen Malthouse again from Alberta, Canada, explaining that why a vaccine may not be necessary, and also about the enormous amount of surveillance which is coming in.
These vaccines are not safe. We have the Pfizer vaccine coming out in Canada, and you know that they skipped animal studies for this, and the ones that they did do with animals, with monkeys, for example, the vaccine did not protect them from getting reinfected. So what we know about these vaccines, the Pfizer vaccine particularly, but also Moderna vaccine, is they do not prevent you from getting the infection. And they do not prevent you from passing on the infection. So you'll still be wearing masks and social distancing and all those, I would say, absurd public health policies. But you'll still have to do that because you'll still be contagious. But what they do is they're told that they reduce the symptoms by a small amount. So your nose may not run as much. That's pretty much all you can expect from those vaccines. Now, when they looked at the effectiveness of those vaccines, they said, well, you know, when we started measuring after 2 weeks, after your second shot of the vaccine, people had less symptoms. And it was 95% reduction of minor symptoms. And so it was described as being 95% effective. But if you include all the adverse effects of the shot itself, which were, many of them were level 2 and some level 3, we had transverse myelitis, we had some very serious people, we had four cases of Bell's palsy. When you add those into the effects that people got when they were later exposed to the natural coronavirus, we see that the number of symptoms that were the collection of the two, the adverse effects from the shot itself, plus the wild coronavirus contagion symptoms, that those far outweighed what you would get if you didn't do anything. So it makes much more sense to actually get the wild virus than it does to get the shot, just from the point of view of what it can do. And it's not protecting you or your loved ones from getting infected. So, you know, it's not going to stop any so-called pandemic, which doesn't really exist anyway.
Right. But is it too soon to maybe tell? Like, I believe they just started vaccinating people in the UK just a week or two ago, right? So have we seen any adverse effects yet from those countries that are...
Yeah. Yeah, we have. We've seen people with allergic reactions. Now, the thing about coronavirus is they're peculiar. They tried to make coronavirus vaccines after the first SARS in 2003, but they were not able to succeed after, you know, trying for almost 20 years. And the reason for that is because they have a funny thing about coronavirus. It's called paradoxical immune enhancement. So what it means is that when people got the shot initially, they developed quite high antibody levels, and the researchers thought this is great. But when they were exposed to the wild virus, they actually developed this immune overreaction, this bradykinin storm that we've seen with, you know, what we experienced in the in early part of the year. And then these people, a lot of them got very sick. And this is what they saw with animals, that many of the animals, almost all of them died in those research studies. Of course, they've skipped animal studies in a lot of these most recent trials for COVID vaccine. When they did a very similar one with with what's called respiratory syncytial virus in children in the 1950s, they tested 35 children, and 80% of them ended up in the hospital when they were exposed to the wild virus after getting the shot, and two of those children died. So they really stopped doing this type of vaccine investigation and production in this particular type of virus. This is a very dangerous experiment that's going on right now, and they're using humans as guinea pigs. That's why we're waiting now to see what happens after you roll it out among Canadians, is Canadians are going to be guinea pigs. And I tell you, I would not take the vaccine myself.
So you're saying that you wouldn't take the vaccine, and you are a medical doctor. Are you advising your patients not to, or you're just not saying anything?
Informed consent is very important. So I think patients can make their own decision of whether they want to have the virus, this vaccine for COVID-19. I would say there's no benefits for it. It may reduce your symptoms a little bit, but it will not protect you from getting infected. And the chances of having an immune overreaction that is triggered by the vaccine is so very high that it's going to be much more dangerous than it's going to be beneficial. So I would tell my patients that and let them make the decision. I don't think I would actually be giving my patients a vaccine, because the first part of the Hippocratic Oath is to do no harm. So I would, I think, be restricted in giving them something I thought was very, very likely to cause them harm.
Now, Dr. Malthouse, are there other doctors that feel the same way that you do?
Yes, there are doctors all across Canada and all around the world that are saying the same thing, but nobody is listening to them. We're rolling out an agenda that is not based on science or evidence. And you'd have to ask yourself why that is. Why would public health be trying to push a vaccine, which they almost have to mandate and coerce you into getting if it's that great? It's because it's very dangerous. And it fits an agenda which does not match public health as it should be. There should be a lot of questions coming up people's minds as to what is going on here, because our government, our public health, our institutions, they're all pushing something which scientists and epidemiologists, vaccine researchers, people that have been actually in the field all their lives are saying is not good for the public. And yet it's being pushed.
You raise an interesting point, because one thing that is of particular concern is the move by politicians and many media outlets to shut down any vigorous debate and any dissenting medical opinions on this issue, right? So how can it be a bad thing to have an open discussion on what the best approach might be to handle the challenges of COVID-19?
Exactly right. When you have censorship like this, you have to ask yourself, why is it that all the platforms on the internet, all the mainstream media, that they're completely censoring scientists and doctors around the world? And there's a reason for that, because they have an agenda, and the agenda is to push the vaccine. Now, why would they push a vaccine? Well, it could be that it's going to kill a lot of people. It could be intended to do that. The second one would be that we're looking at passports. Now, passports are a way of tagging you and making sure they know where you are and what you've got. So we could make a lot of money on the vaccines. That's one possibility. The other one is for surveillance. And now surveillance will lead us down further paths. In other words, the vaccine may not be mandated in Canada. Well, I'm sure there will be attempts to do that. But it certainly will. People will be coerced. By that, I mean that they will not be able to go on airplanes. They will not be able to travel public transport. Employment may be based on having the vaccine. You may not be able to go into public spaces. All those types of coercion will come out, and people will be forced to take it. Now, the other thing is that the attack on Main Street and getting rid of little businesses, small and medium-sized businesses, means that people will be desperate. They'll have to close their stores because of all these, you know, artificial lockdowns, which are not doing any good whatsoever, and people being afraid to go out into public and to go to stores. So those stores are going to lose their business, and they're going to go out of business, and subsequently people will be impoverished, and they'll be starving. And so they'll do whatever the government says to get a handout, food and a little bit of money. And in that will be have the vaccine and also to be tagged and surveilled. So that's what's coming next.
Well, that's Dr. Stephen Malthouse. Before we hear from David Halpin, Martin, what's being painted here is quite an incredible project. In fact, one might even call it eugenics, a deliberate twisting of the facts and stifling of the doctors who are talking about what is basically, you know, a serendipitous parasitic drug which can help people get over this, and maybe which hundreds of thousands of people, particularly in the Western world, may be dead now because this hasn't been used. Whereas, for example, in Asia, in Africa, where chloroquine and these other drugs are more normal, ivermectin is now being used apparently in South America in several countries as a regular cure for COVID. It seems that there's an enormous block in the Western world where these basic cures are not being talked about, and what is being talked about instead is a vaccine, vaccine, vaccine. We're hearing nothing but vaccine.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think even in the mainstream, there is a an understanding that vaccines for COVID, you know, for coronaviruses are unlikely to work. I mean, we've been trying to find a cure, you know, a vaccine for the common cold for decades, and they've not been able to find one because it just mutates too fast and makes it impossible. So there's definitely, you know, big pharma in the West is pushing vaccines. And of course, the Pfizer people who jumped in there first, the chief executive arranged to sell his shares and buy them back at the same price several months later, and made millions of dollars on what was essentially insider trading, because it, you know, it came true, you know, it came through just on the day that they announced that they'd found the vaccine. So I think what we've got to do with this is it's like a Russian doll. You've got to take each bit of it and examine each bit of it, because the problem with people who are critical of the mainstream narrative is that they tend to have a scattergun effect. You know, we're talking about lockdowns, we're talking about vaccines, we're talking about masks, as if it's all part of the same thing or exactly the same thing, when all of these things are separable and need to be looked at individually. What I think it probably is a man-made bioweapon. It probably may have been developed in the Wuhan laboratory, which, of course, had its investments in it.
Martin, there's a much bigger question, isn't there? And that even if it is, why is it that many people, it seems, have been deliberately allowed to die? I mean, you could almost call it a lethal injection, the vaccine, whereas actually people could be popping a pill and getting well, at least something like between two-thirds and three-quarters of them, with no need for this injection.
If it's a bioweapon, it's designed to kill a certain number of people, and it's designed to kill a certain number of people to fulfil various economic or political objectives.
Well, that is interesting,
so,
isn't it?
So therefore, you certainly don't want to give them easy cures, because the purpose of it is warfare.
The idea is this could be, couldn't it, economic warfare by the pharmaceutical industry?
Yes. Well, no, I would suggest Larry Romanoff has done the best analysis of this. In my view, that it's probably a biological warfare attack. And don't forget, a biological warfare agent isn't designed to kill everybody. It's designed to sow social mistrust so that an economy is messed up. So this time last year, they were hoping that by seeding it in Wuhan, possibly through the military games that took place there, we can actually mess up the Chinese economy just as it's about to overtake the US economy. But what's...
Okay, well, anyway, look, I'd like to hear a final comment from David, but after we've heard from a woman called Helen Wildbore, she's from the Families and Residents Associations of Care Homes, and she is putting forward something very obvious and logical here, which many, many people who have relatives in care homes are wondering too, which is how come care staff are able to wander freely in and out of these places, and some of them working at multiple care homes, and yet relatives are not even allowed on the premises in many places, let alone to be able to wave at their relative through the window or something. So there seems to be an enormous hypocrisy there. And the other thing she explained was that there are all sorts of insurance and financial reasons why the care homes are being told, rather like we had Dr. Simone Gold telling us that her clinical director at her hospital was saying she wasn't allowed to use a certain drug. Well, the same thing is happening in our care homes, where care home managers are telling staff and telling relatives that basically they're just following instructions from insurance companies, but they don't really tell you that. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Helen Wildbore explaining the kind of contradictions where these care staff are going in and out of the hospitals, seeing relatives, loved ones all the time, whereas actual relatives are not allowed on the premises.
Care staff are obviously able to come and go from care homes and, you know, live their lives as you would expect them to do when they're not at work. But that the family members and the friends have been stopped from visiting. And we have to remember that many family members and friends don't do visits just for that social element, which is, of course, really important, but many people are going in to provide really short support. So it could be help with eating, for example, and emotional support to help relieve distress of dementia, or to help with, you know, communications and those mental health issues that I talked about. And that can actually help care homes. You know, we've seen lots of care staff who've had to go off sick or self-isolate because of the virus. We hear of lots of staff shortages within the home. If we allow those essential family carers back in to be able to provide that kind of crucial practical emotional support, it would help the care home and help to ensure that residents' rights can be respected. And of course, it'd have to be all the same safety precautions that staff have to meet in terms of testing, appropriate PPE and access to vaccinations and that kind of thing. But as you say, there are other barriers here around facilitating those visits. And we've heard about the problems with providers getting insurance, as you mentioned. And we've joined calls for the government to actually step in and indemnify care homes and sort of unblock the restrictive insurance policies that they're facing in the same way that they have, the government has with the NHS.
Amazing, David, isn't it? The financial sector seems to be basically deciding whether you can touch your elderly loved ones or not.
I couldn't hear that evidence very clearly, Tony. Did you want me to sum up a bit?
Yes.
Well, first of all, they've produced hysteria through fear. That was, I understand, minuted at a SAGE meeting to instill fear. What is the overall intention? It's to speed societal disintegration, which was already advanced in our country and in the US, as is plain at the moment. And the basic drive is eugenic, no question. It is a fact that people like Gates, with his many billions of a system, from a system which he filled from someone else, understand, his many billions are funding all sorts of activity around the world, including viral labs. Some of his funds go to the London School of Medicine and Tropical Hygiene, where Professor Whitty is employed in his research. And so the basic is one of our group is a retired GP. She retired a bit early, but she spoke about culling, and I could hardly believe it. But I'm afraid I've come round to that view, that instead of doctors and nurses and everyone who cares for other human beings, everyone, wanting the best for everyone, the profession that I'm part of does not care as much as it did. And if they look at my website, the website of David Halpin, they will find an open letter to Torbay Hospital. It's quite long, actually. It also describes my own history and my own maltreatment as well by doctors. This is not conspiracy, it's a fact. But I describe 8 cases. One of them, case 1, I have never seen such abysmal treatment in my life. And it goes on. I'm seeing this lady tomorrow, actually this patient, a lady of about 76, who's suffering pain now, 17 weeks after she broke her elbow in a violent fall. If you look at that letter, and there's a second letter saying what I had heard from Torbay Hospital, the Royal Devon Exeter Hospital, and the useless clinical commissioning group, they are irrelevant, but they have purse strings. If you read those letters, you will see what I'm getting at. The level of care, of human concern, has reached rock bottom. It saddens me greatly. And I see this letter to my wife today asking her to go for her COVID vaccination without telling which product of the three it is. But it's signed, the end of the 3-page letter, by 8 general practitioners at the local practice. They're roping in patients from the practices all around Newton Abbott. There'll be about 50 GPs altogether, I'd imagine. And all of them are willing accomplices to a scheme which has no need. Mortality in most people is minute from this disease. It is a disease, no question. Very odd, very odd, very odd disease. But the only people who should have been protected, as Witkowski said, and the Ioannidis said, and who were censored immediately, the people that we should have looked after were the frail elderly who are on the edge of life. I've dealt with hundreds of them. I used to look after people with hip fractures, mostly old ladies. Some of them were very frail, often had other conditions, so-called comorbidities. These people were just on the edge of life. And if an influenza virus of a more vicious sort came around one winter, that would carry them off with bronchopneumonia. In this case, some of them have died with COVID-19 because of the evil of it, the culling. They sent patients who'd had COVID-19 in hospital, they were sent off to care homes. And I heard today from one of our members in our group that, interestingly, the lady managers accepted those patients in those care homes, but most of the male managers of care homes said they would not take patients who'd be in contact with C19 in hospital. There was a deliberate culling of the frail elderly early in this.
Okay, look, David, the $64,000 question here is, why are doctors complicit in actually harming patients rather than curing them and helping them?
Tony, I do not know, but all I can say, I don't know what it is, you can start talking about Freemasonry or whatever. I know some doctors have cold hearts, but I never thought that so many would be ciphers that would just fall into line and do exactly what the government's telling them. They're telling patients they can go to the pharmacies for this thing. They're not given... One of the key things is informed consent. If you give an invasive drug, an invasive agent to anyone, you are to tell them what the benefits are, and you have to tell them what the side effects are. In the case of the three vaccines, two of which aren't true vaccines anyway, they don't know because the trials have been very short and they haven't, interestingly, used them, injected the very elderly with them. They have, in fact, since they rolled it out. But in the trials, they were mostly younger, fitter people. That's a very important distinction. But the thing is this, that doctors have fallen into line. The Royal Colleges, every one of them, is yakking about. I get messages about every two or three days from Royal College of Surgeons, and it's all the same stuff about, you know, the pandemic and what have you. They've stopped later operating pretty well. There's a vast backlog, which we'll never catch up on. This is it, Tony. This is my final message. I wrote two articles for Global Research. They're also on my website. One of them was masking the COVID virus about 3 weeks ago. The last one was on Global Research, and it was titled "The UK, the Global Lab Rat." This is very important. Don't forget that the first rollouts of these ruddy vaccines were in this country. They're not necessary. They're not necessary. Why in this country? Because I think this, that they knew this country stood alone in 1939, and the ingenuity and grit of the British people then was a big factor in us beating the Nazi, the Third Reich. That's a factor. If they can beat Britain, they'll beat any country, although happily other countries like Venezuela perhaps are coming to the fore. Our people are now ductile, they do as they're told, but even so, down below, as I've indicated, there's some resistance in this country. And that is why we are the global lab rat. That's why it's been rolled out early here. The analogy is the NHS. The NHS has been under attack for about 40 years. There have been doctors in it, and the managers and what have you, they've been inserted to help with destruction, a process I've called destabilize, demoralize, dismantle. It's far advanced, and this may be the coup de grace to COVID-19. But the thing is, if you can dismantle the only so-called socialized medical system in the world still surviving, then you know that private medicine, the fee per item of service, will win out throughout the world. In the Middle East, it's standard. All around the world, it's pretty well standard. You have to find a shekel to get your treatment. But if they can take the NHS down here, they've won. So the NHS is a microcosm in a way, but employing about a million people. But the greater thing is control. And Mr. Gates, as you know, wants to see everyone in the world immunized. Immunized for what? This psychopath is not a doctor, but he's driving it. If you look online, you will find a list of his donations from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Massive amounts of money, including like 25,000 quid to the London School of Tropical Medicine, where Whitty works.
Well, hang on, because the Imperial College, Neil Ferguson has been popping up all over the news again this week. He's basically got a department, an entire department at Imperial College, all funded by Bill Gates. He decided on the, he was the person who recommended the original lockdown back in March.
Yes.
And then he was found to not even believe in it himself by ignoring his own rules.
Yes.
And supposedly he was sacked. And yet he is still making policy. In fact, he's one the main person on NERVTAG, the other committee, which is behind this present system that we have.
I know, Tony. And I tell you this, the Imperial College, which my alma mater, St. Mary's, was bound into with Charing Cross and the Westminster, the Imperial College is a laundering exercise. They're also big on climate change. Did you know that? Funds come from New York, I know this, to Imperial College, and that helps fund some of the more local climate change agenda groups.
Okay, well, anyway, David, can I just ask you to repeat your website, how people can follow your work?
I'll just get it up. I can never remember it straight off. You don't like me using Google, I know that. Let's put up here quickly. Here we are. It's D Halpin, D for David, Halpin, H-A-L-P-I-N, infoaction.org.uk. And https://2/ dhalpin.infoaction, infoaction.org.uk. My website is very well constructed by a very good friend, and it's filled with my passion for the truth, Tony. And I'm so pleased and honoured that you asked me to contribute tonight.
Well, thank you. God bless. Thank you very much for being on, David. Lovely to hear from you. So I'll put a link up to your site on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much for joining us, David. Now, Martin, I wonder what you make of this whole business of Gates funding so many of these people. I suppose we're coming back to the same sort of question again, aren't we? And what David's saying there about that, actually, there's a big agenda here which is affecting the National Health Service. Possibly this could be the end for them.
Well, I think that there is definitely an agenda going on here, because I think that the creation, I mean, I can't prove this. This is just coppers' hunches. But I think that COVID-19 was deliberately created in order to kill people, in order to bring in all of the control mechanisms that you're discussing, including breaking up the National Health Service, etc. I think that it was deliberately seeded inside China. But I think it may, in fact, have accidentally leaked from Fort Detrick, although it may be the case that it was deliberately placed inside China. And I understand that there's going to be revelations this week about how it is actually, it's coming from the Trump camp, about how it is actually a man-made virus, and that it came from the Wuhan laboratory. You see David Davis, and that the sort of anti-China faction within the Tory party about to bang the drum about this. Now, I think the fact that the Chinese have reacted so strongly to this suggests that they probably know that it's man-made, either because they leaked it by accident themselves. I don't think they deliberately would have allowed themselves to be infected with it, but they're certainly treating it as if it's a biological warfare attack. So the recent outbreak in Hubei province, all the rhetoric that the Chinese are using around it is warfare rhetoric. You know, this is a war, they're saying it's a war against the virus, but the kinds of things they're doing are the kind of things they would do in wartime. Now, I'm perfectly happy to go along with all of that. I think there's plenty of things to say about that. I haven't got much, I think the vaccine companies in the West definitely are profiteers. There may well be an agenda to control society. It's given a massive excuse to the financial services sector to be bailed out yet again. So Rishi Sunak, who used to be an alumni of Goldman Sachs and supposedly a free marketeer, is printing money like it's going out of fashion and popping up.
Yes. I mean, the other side of this, of course, is that millions and millions, possibly even tens of millions of people have been completely shut out of the economy. But anyway, look, we're getting back to the economy. Let's get back to COVID.
I'm not a doctor, Tony. I'm an economist, so it's the economy I'm talking about, and I'm a political economist. So we're discussing this as a biological warfare agent, and then all the response to it, of course, is in order to fulfil these various control fantasies of the Western elite.
Economic warfare. Anyway, one of the things that many people have seen him, he's done very well up on YouTube, a guy called Dr. John Campbell. And this really does, it's amazing, isn't it? The vaccines have come out, they're being rolled out, there's the hard sell on the mass media. And, you know, as we just heard from David, he's not even being told what type of vaccine his wife's being offered, which is obviously there's a big difference between them. You might wish, for example, I would say if you got to have a vaccine, if you feel you do, that the probably the safest one is the Sputnik vaccine, the Russian one, which seems to be a much more of a traditional type of vaccine, which cannot get into other cells in your organs and things like that. But anyway, as a sidebar to all of this, you've got John Campbell explaining that actually it looks as if all those people who had COVID won't need a vaccination anyway because they have long-term post-infection immunity. So let's have a listen to Dr. John Campbell, who's made a bit of a name for himself up on YouTube, as has Vernon Coleman, who we'll be hearing from in a minute, talking about post-infection immunity.
The good news relates to reinfection. So this study looked at a large cohort of healthcare providers in the north of England. And it looked at the ones that got infected in the first wave back in sort of March, April time. And then they looked at the second wave and they found that none of those got reinfected. Not only did none of them get reinfected, none of them developed asymptomatic infection. So this is looking really good for immunity, what, 6-7 months on. Now, we know that with SARS coronavirus 1, which caused the 2002-2003 outbreak, that the immunity from that can last for up to 17, getting on for 18 years. Now, the reason we know that is it's been 17 or 18 years since people were infected with SARS coronavirus 1. But of course, people only started getting infected with SARS coronavirus 2 at the start of 2020. And we know towards the end of 2020, they were still immune. So looking good at the 6 month stage. And I think it's going to look good for some time. We don't know that, of course, because the time simply hasn't passed.
Yeah, so that's he does a very good job, I think, in some ways. In he does a nice little summary at the beginning of his. He does a longer talk where he explains it. Dr. John Campbell, there talking about post-infection immunity. But we've also got our old friend Dr. Stanley Laham. His 70-year-old friend contacted him with COVID-19, and he describes here how he treated his friend, a lady. Which I thought was quite fascinating, and he explains why. No, she definitely doesn't need a vaccine, but this is really all related to whether you get your immunity from a vaccine or whether you get it from catching the disease itself. So let's have a listen to Dr. Stanley Laham again. We've got a much longer interview with him, which I recorded earlier this week, a second one, because I recorded him saying, this is back last year, something which has been banned from YouTube, where he actually says your cells become the virus, when he's talking about the mRNA vaccines, the new Pfizer and Moderna types, which many people are now saying that shouldn't really be called vaccines because they're experimental treatments and they're not actually vaccines, they're not the traditional type of vaccine. So let's have a listen to Stanley Laham now, doctor from Florida, who spent his whole life as an immunologist and teaching at the University of Florida and working in industry too, talking about what happened with his 70-year-old friend.
If you have it, it has been shown that you retain memory cells for about 6 months. You could come in, you know, in contact with it again, but then you would have what they call a secondary immune response. And that's what it's all about. When you get vaccinated, you get a primary immune response. That doesn't mean, even if you get the vaccine, that you're not going to catch the COVID-19. You are going to get the COVID-19, but then you're going to have a secondary response. And you're protected. Because you're immediately, what would take 4 to 5 days will take 12 hours to 24 hours in the secondary response. you eliminate the virus before it has time to spread. Well, the same thing for people who had COVID once. When they get it twice, if you get it, you know, a second time, then you get a secondary response. The first time you got it is as if you were vaccinated. The vaccine will not do more than the people who caught it once. I'll give you a simple example. I have a good friend of mine. She's 70 years old, and she tested positive and had symptoms, called me on the phone, was very congested, got her on a regimen of ivermectin, doxycycline, zinc, vitamin D, and high doses of vitamin C. Within 2 weeks, she was completely well. After 3 weeks, she went to do the test, and she told me, I'm negative. The PCR test shows that I'm negative. She did it twice. Does that mean I don't have to take any vaccine, that I'm immune to it? I said, well, let's make sure of that. Let's make sure, because the PCR test, which she tested positive to begin with, has a nasty habit, about 10% false positive. I told her, let's make sure that that's exactly what you had. So I sent her to have a blood test for neutralizing antibodies, and she tested positive. I told her, now you're assured. Since you do have the antibodies, you do have the neutralizing antibodies, now you're sure you had the COVID-19, that it wasn't a false positive. You don't have to take any vaccine.
What you're saying is you don't need the vaccine in that case?
Absolutely not. They would be turning immunology upside down to tell me that if you actually had the actual coronavirus, you got over it, you have neutralizing antibodies, that you would need the vaccine also. That would be a stupidity.
Well, that's Dr. Stanley Dahan, the University of Florida, retired. They're explaining how he successfully treated his one of his patients, Martin, with ivermectin.
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly, you know, the question is raised of why aren't we using generic drugs when we can, when they want to push these complex new technology vaccines. And you see this in general before we had the recent crisis. Is developing countries for years have been pushing to be able to use basic drugs, generic drugs. But of course, what blocks that in the World Trade Organization is the multinational pharmaceutical companies based in the West, like GlaxoSmithKline, etc., because they want patented drugs, which basically it guarantees money for their shareholders. So, you know, if we come to the question of what is this all about? And of course, the doctors are talking about, you know, medical stuff, but then they're moving into what you might call the territory of economics and politics. And that's where I feel more capable of making a constructive contribution.
Yeah. Okay.
And
We have a listen to Dr. Vernon Coleman now. He was speaking to Richie Allen. Richie Allen apparently has got a wonderful new website up now. And he's far, far more dedicated than I am, as he has an almost daily show during the week. And also at the weekend, too. I think he does one on a Sunday as well. Although he has a Friday afternoon show, so you can listen to us after you've listened to Richie on a Friday if you wish. But anyway, I just think Richie does an absolutely fantastic job on getting some of this stuff out. And he has every Monday, he has Dr. Vernon Coleman on. And you were hinting there, Martin, about the idea of having, something which is a bit more of a deeper look rather than just looking at the clinical stuff. And Dr. Vernon Coleman definitely does that. And the amazing thing about him is not only is he the author of How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You, so he's very capable of being self-critical, and he's looked and seen that the pharmaceutical industry over the years has concentrating much more on actually making people sick and dependent on their products rather than actually curing people. But he's also got a much wider view because of the long, long time he's done working in the British mass media. Now he cannot speak to them. Apparently he's not interested, they're not interested in hearing from him at all. So they're not interested in his second opinion. So let's hear a little bit about the Agenda 21 and what Dr. Vernon Coleman thinks. Getting into your territory maybe, Martin, it'd be interesting to see what you have to say about what he has to say when we've heard from Dr. Vernon Coleman talking about Agenda 21 on The Richie Allen Show.
I've said right since March that I thought it was just another flu, an ordinary flu. I said then, and I still believe, that it was never anything like a plague. In fact, the total number of deaths for this year are much the same, in fact, a bit less than a normal year. But all that's happened is that all the flu cases and a lot of everything else has been renamed as COVID-19 deaths. And incidentally, I wish people would stop writing it with capitals. You don't write malaria in capital letters or influenza in capital letters. So why write COVID in capital letters? It just dignifies an ordinary flu thing. I know about all the arguments about whether it's exosomes and whether 5G is triggering it and so on and so forth. Personally, I don't believe there's a special disease called COVID plague. It's a flu. It's a flu variant. But I don't think that the question of what's actually behind it is the key at the moment. I think what we have to be fighting on is what they're doing. Otherwise, we get stuck up in semantics and we get going around following ourselves in circles. What we have to do is try to get out to more people. We have to reach more people who aren't convinced. We have to change views. That's why I keep saying send leaflets around. Send videos and some copies of books and stuff, the free ones. Send them off to everybody, to journalists, to school teachers, to lawyers, to anybody you can think of who might be a bit of an influencer, because there's a danger that these things will just go round within a small, relatively small group. I know there's a lot of people who think like you and I do and who are aware that this is a hoax and that there's a reason behind it. It hasn't happened by accident. Nothing they do happens by accident. The whole thing's planned and has been planned for years. But the problem is that if we just keep circulating our discontent among ourselves, we will never get out
to the
mass of people who are unconvinced. And there's three layers of people at the moment. There's people who believe this is a hoax. There's people who will believe forever that whatever the government says is true and wonderful and Bill Gates is a magnificent man and so on and so forth. And there's the people in the middle who suspect that there's something fishy going on, who don't really believe what's happening, but in the infamous words that I've heard and seen time and time again, oh, well, I wear my mask because it's easier than making a fuss.
Yeah.
If you don't make a fuss and you wear your mask and you do everything else that they want you to do, then we have lost. And losing doesn't mean just that we lose our liberty forever. It doesn't just mean that we lose all our freedoms of speech and so on forever. It means that we're going to be left with 500 million people on the planet, because that's the plan. That's part of Agenda 21. We have to spread the word as wide and as far as we possibly can. And there are risks. You'll upset people. You might lose a friend or a neighbor. And I would go so far as to say that if you haven't lost someone or offended someone, then you're not doing your part in spreading the truth. Because if we don't do that, we're the ones who have to do it. It's our responsibility. No one else is going to do it. The BBC isn't going to do it. No MP is going to do it. We have to do it ourselves.
Martin, what do you make of that? He's a doctor who's getting almost into your territory, into political territory there.
He is, and he's saying that it's just a form of flu. Whereas, of course, one of the things I've been saying, and various other people that you've been interviewing this week, are saying that it's basically an engineered virus. Now, it can't be just another form of flu and an engineered virus. It's got to be one or the other. And I tend to the view that it is an engineered virus, precisely because of the kind of response you've seen in China, where they had an initial, they got the test, you know, basically they treated it as a biological warfare attack. And by treating it as a biological warfare attack, they've created a situation where possibly a quarter of humanity doesn't need a vaccine because they haven't got coronavirus inside China. They haven't got coronavirus inside New Zealand now. They haven't got coronavirus in Taiwan. There are various parts of the world where they haven't got any coronavirus and there is no lockdown. The economy is functioning. It's not functioning here because it's designed to wreck economies. They wanted to wreck the Chinese economy as the first billiard ball, and then it was to flow back over the Western economies so they could bail out the banks and carry out this coup attempt, if you like, on the society. And therefore, this is actually like 9/11, but on a bigger scale. But it's because it's a biological warfare agent and we are at war. And we're not at war against lockdown. Lockdown is the only thing that will stop it because the vaccines, as you pointed out, don't work. So in actual fact, the places where they've locked down efficiently and with the right perspective, and we had that guy from the GRU on some months ago now saying that the Russian intelligence services see this as an attack on China. That's how I see it as well. And it isn't just about not wearing masks to the supermarket and our liberties and all the rest of it. That's frankly, it's infantile. We are dealing with a collapse of the banking system, a biological warfare attack on humanity designed to kill a lot of people, but then allow further things to happen. And we are indeed at war, but not by fighting with people about wearing a mask going to the supermarket. That's a diversion.
Vernon Coleman is actually author of a book, Proof That Masks Do More Harm Than Good, which has been banned, of course, by YouTube and Facebook and the rest of them. But all he's doing, Martin, in that book is quoting official studies, including the World Health Organization, who changed their web page around about July, August last year.
I think one of the problems you've got with people who are critical of the mainstream narrative around COVID is the scattergun effect, where everything to do with COVID, including, say, wearing masks or vaccines, it's all lumped in together as one conspiracy to control humanity, etc. I see it in terms of geopolitics. We've got a change in the international system, which, you know, we're now at the inflection point between 1945 and now. It's and the possibility of a global war to reestablish the pecking order is very, very palpable. And that, of course, is related to 9/11, which was an inside attack carried out by the US security forces on their own population. People would say, well, why would a government carry out an attack on its own population? The same would be true of COVID. Why would they want to infect their own population with COVID? Now, the fact is that the political leadership in a country like Britain will not really know what's going on. They don't get told what's going on. They just get shooed along behind the scenes. And of course, you had John Campbell on there earlier. I actually have been following his stuff quite closely, and he's actually quite close to the mainstream. For example, he is in favour of lockdowns, as I am. I think that's the only way to resolve the problem. And that the idea that a lockdown kills the economy and there's a trade-off, there isn't a trade-off. If you don't go for zero transmission, the economy is going to remain completely debilitated. Well, and, of course, in China, the economy is picking up.
Some people argue we've already got herd immunity in Britain.
I would disagree. I don't think we have. I don't believe in going for herd immunity. And in China, they didn't even attempt to go for herd immunity. They're not going to go for herd immunity. The countries that go for herd immunity are going to be debilitated for the next 5 or 10 years. The countries where they've got no COVID, like China, are going to forge ahead. And that's why they are going to win World War III and the West is going to lose. And Agenda 21 is a lot of flim-flam, as is the so-called Great Reset, because ultimately the Western powers have overreached themselves and they're going to come a cropper here.
OK, well, our final doctor tonight is Dr. Carrie Madej, MADEJ, and she was in part of a conversation called The Most Relevant Conversation. Well, this is the way the Americans do things, I suppose. They call it something very obvious, which is, you know, makes it sound a bit trite. But anyway, here she is giving her sort of spiritual, I suppose, perspective. And we're going to be hearing from Tim Cohen finally. But Dr. Carrie Madday, The Most Relevant Conversation, here she talks about what she thinks is the sort of spiritual aspects, the spiritual warfare aspects of COVID.
The difference between the enslavement of humanity as it is now and what the future is they want mind, body, and soul. It was just body. Now it's our soul and our mind. I mean, that it's that simple and that horrifying, and that's why we need to get the message out. As far as my colleagues and how they're responding, you know, my profession, like other professions, has been indoctrinated and dumbed down, to say it's sad. They've stopped critical thinking. And you have to know that we lost freedom of speech in my profession a long time ago. If you speak up just a little bit, as we all have seen in recent events, you're fired right away. And you're not just fired, you're blackballed from the industry. Good luck trying to find another job. And what do we do as doctors, right? You know, you just can't find that. So that's been going on for some time. And as an attending physician for medical students, I saw that they were teaching them less and less in the schools. They were teaching them less critical thinking, less independent thinking. And so this plan has been in act for a long time. Look at the new math they've been teaching kids. They believe any numbers that come in front of the screen without even thinking about where they came from. This is why they can put the number of COVID cases and everybody believes it without having that critical thinking. We have had such of this brainwashing technology going on and education for so long, and it's hit the professions as well. And so the few of my colleagues that are still critical thinkers, they're just afraid. They're trying to survive, right? And they're afraid to say something. They say something quietly, but they're afraid to say it out loud. And I don't know when that trigger event's going to happen that will really get them to be brave enough to finally speak up, because now I'm calling them out. I'm getting harsher with my words. I said, you know what? We took an oath to do no harm. Okay, that was an oath. And we have people's lives in our hands. Not just a product, we have their lives in our hands. And so if you are a part of this system where you're coercing someone to be part of an experiment, you're telling them that it's safe when you don't know it's safe. You're telling them that it's effective when we know it's not effective. I mean, what is that? That's on your heart. You know, I mean, we're talking and I tell them, please remember your oath, A. Number two, please remember we are in a war. And it's not just a physical war. We are in a spiritual war. And you know what? I'm getting more response now from people that are waking up. They're like, you know what? You're right. It is a spiritual war. They're quietly. They're saying it quietly. But we need people to sing it loud, okay? Say it from their heart, okay? It's a mind, body, soul. So let's get our heart involved. And I talk about, you know, some good science, right? We always hear about the bad science right now. Heart Math Institute. I love them. So they've done studies on us. We are electrical beings. So our heart is electromagnetic, and it is 100,000 times more powerful than our brain, the most powerful organ in our body. And it connects all of us. It connects the body, the mind, and the spirit. It really does. And so in a normal, weak human, it goes out 6 feet. In a strong, powerful human, kilometers. It goes out several kilometers, probably more. We don't have the equipment to measure that. And I think that's fantastic. And if we can awaken that fire, wow, spread that's like beautiful. Kindling.
Well, that's Dr. Carrie Madday there, talking, I suppose, about auras. Martin, do you believe in auras?
Well, I think if you're going to make medical arguments, and we've just been talking medical arguments for 2 hours, if you want to talk about auras, you can talk about auras, but you're going to find that lots of people are going to switch off at that point, because doctors, as medical doctors, are not in a position. As she said, we haven't got the instruments to measure this. So if you want to, if you start bundling all of this together, don't wear masks, it's all about auras, it's all spiritual, etc., then you lose the technical detail, which I presume is the purpose of having long shows like this where we go through the technical details.
Fair enough. Okay, so we'll finish tonight with which I suppose is a game. You know, I'm not sure if you'd like it, Martin, but it's a look at a biblical prophecy, the Book of Revelation, and some of the things which appear to be unfolding. But it is actually in a way quite technical, because it's a look at the worship of money, and it's a look at the bringing in of a new religion based on the worship of money. And of course, as we know, many of our religions, they point to love of money being the root of all evils, which is a fairly strong way to put it. But we're going to have a listen now to Tim Cohen, where he talks about the worship of money as something which the Antichrist will promote. One of the things I found fascinating about this, though, Martin, he's looking really ahead at the role that Prince Charles is likely to play as a Middle East peace broker. And he says that he's going to be very much a kind of pro-Palestinian, which I found quite fascinating. Of course, if you did want to start World War III and the Israelis were going to be a big part of it, someone who was on the international world stage, who was sticking up for the Palestinians, could be in a very powerful position, couldn't they?
Well, I think, the fact that Prince Charles is pushing what is essentially the more establishment agenda in Britain, which is an even-handed approach in theory between Palestinian and Israeli claims, wouldn't surprise me. He's part of the British establishment, and that's the line he's taking. But, of course, Trump, on the other hand, recognised Jerusalem as the capital of Israel against massive international opposition, and Joe Biden has surrounded himself with pro-Israeli figures, as has Keir Starmer. And so, in other words, the idea of Prince Charles as the embodiment of evil just doesn't wash. He's basically
Martin, we're not really talking about that at the moment. What we're saying is that he could be in an extremely powerful position as a peace broker in the future, should war break out.
Well, no, he won't, because there isn't going to be any peace. So there's nothing. He's basically bleating from the sidelines saying, can't everybody be nice to each other? And I'm afraid since the Israelis were involved in the 9/11 attack and were in World War III, it's a bit late for that.
What do you think about it's going to happen when the Queen steps aside, as she may be doing in a couple of months? Any thoughts on that one?
Well, if she's I haven't seen anything that suggests that she is, but even if she did, he then becomes the king, because that's the constitution of the country, unless he abdicates. And, I think the focus on him and on the Book of Revelation rather undermines discussions, what I want to bring it back to, which is the collapse of capitalism and World War III.
Well, I think that's probably because we take slightly different approaches, Martin. I mean, I'm very interested in as a Christian, I'm very interested in the parallels we see sometimes between biblical prophecy and also just simply moral right and wrong, as written in the Bible, particularly, or in other places too, and world events. And we definitely seem to be seeing a kind of sorting out of the sheep and the goats, as the Bible puts it, at the moment, with COVID, into various camps who are critical of Gates and others who are pro-Gates. He seems to be quite a key figure. And also the way that this is all being used to a much bigger agenda. Now we've got, for the first time, we've got television and we've got nuclear weapons. There is quite a possibility that a global elite might make a grab for world power, isn't there?
They're doing it in front of our eyes. And, of course, the nuclear problem is that we may end up, for example, one of the things Trump may do next week is carry out a limited nuclear strike on Iran's facilities before he's removed from power. And then we won't be arguing about COVID anymore or putting face masks on. We'll be talking about the collapse of the financial system and millions of people dead. And that is actually quite possible. And there's an awful lot of people who are basically fiddling while Rome burns. And that includes people who are trying to go on about our liberties to go to the shop and infect our. I'm basically saying that the countries which have actually implemented lockdowns effectively are now back to normal, and the countries which haven't are going to suffer enormously.
Can I twist your arm to take my point here, that what could be about to unfold with economic collapse, possible war, is of biblical proportions almost?
Yeah, but I don't believe in prophecy, Tony. I believe in fighting to win and being absolutely clear-eyed about what you're up against. I'm not relying on the Antichrist or Jesus, just on human beings.
What do you make of this whole term spiritual warfare then? It's something that the Muslims, for example, have had to go through since 2001.
Well, it's called jihad. And there's the lesser jihad and the greater jihad. And the greater jihad, of course, is to conquer oneself. The lesser jihad is to fight God's enemies. I basically don't believe in things that are beyond human beings. In actual fact, those views can lead to a situation where you are fatalistic about what's going to happen. Therefore, of course, they're self-fulfilling.
I think you have to take a balanced approach. And I, as a journalist, try and look at events and interpret them through, you might say, the prism of the Bible, without actually trying to project at all. Well, we shall see. Anyway, let's finish off with Tim Cohen tonight, talking about what he believes is a sort of system being ushered in, a kind of financial worship using everybody's purchasing power and purchasing ability through electronic purchasing as a kind of system of a religion.
So you make a purchase. When you do that, let's assume for a moment that you've got the barcode on your hand or forehead instead, that it's no longer just on the packaging. And let's assume that the barcode is in an ink that those scanners can read with their lasers, but that it's not visible to the naked eye, which technologically is possible and has been possible now for several years. So let's say you've got a tattoo on your hand or forehead that the scanners can see, but I can't see it with my eyes, okay? You stretch forth your hand or you bow your forehead to that thing for them to scan it. And then let's say they've got the volume turned up and you hear something when you make your purchase, maybe what you're purchasing or your name, your ID, whatever it is. So scripture says that this beast is going to be worshipped, and those who have the mark of the beast are going to worship him and worship it. So here's where this comes together. The technical definition in Greek for the word worship that's translated in English as worship is to bow the forehead, to stretch forth the hand, to bow the knee, to prostrate oneself before as if you were lying on the ground, or to kiss the hand, like, for example, when the Pope stretches forth his hand and somebody kisses the ring on his hand, to kiss the hand. Those are the five technical definitions of the word worship. So if you've got this mark on your hand or your forehead, and you're bowing your forehead, or you're stretching forth your hand, or let's backstep it for a moment. Let's say it's on a card, like a shopper card that you're using. Let's say it's a Costco card, like in the United States, or a Sam's Club card, or a value shopper card, for the grocery store chain where you're shopping, so that you get some discount for your purchase. Most of those cards have UPC or EAN barcodes on them. And so you've got that card in your hand, and you're stretching it forward for somebody to scan it so you can make a purchase, right? Well, you may not have in your mind that you're engaging in any form of worship whatsoever. You may have no spiritual mindedness, if you will, for the act that you're undertaking, which is a simple purchase. But by the technical definition, you are engaged in an act of worship, especially if it's associated ultimately with this Antichrist, this beast. So Prince Charles' coat of arms, his heraldic achievement, not the Queen's, but Prince Charles, has honored all the imagery of Daniel 7 and Revelation 13, as well as other symbols that are explicitly described in the Old and New Testaments for the Antichrist. And then additionally, of course, it's his title by which he's known globally, Charles, Prince of Wales, or Prince Charles of Wales, that calculates the 666. And by the way, Tony, this is in more than one language. So not only is it statistically impossible from a mathematical standpoint, statistically impossible for Charles, Prince of Wales, to calculate to 666 on the English version of the numbering system that we were talking about earlier, where the numbers are sequentially transferred to English. Although that's the reality, the title does calculate to exactly 666 in English. But as it turns out, it does so in more than one language. So in the Hebrew language, on the original numbering system, where you don't actually have to transfer the numbers at all, the exact same title, the way that it's given in modern Israeli Hebrew, Charles, Prince of Wales, or Prince Charles of Wales, also calculates to exactly 666. Mathematically, that's impossible, but it's factual reality.
Okay, so that's Tim Cohen talking about his book, The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, where he says that he believes that all the biblical prophecies about the Antichrist are fulfilled by Prince Charles in various different ways. Some statue that's been done saying Savior of the World with Prince Charles with angels' wings on, as well as the whole idea of his heraldic crest being fulfilling all the various symbols that are there in the Book of Revelation. Anyway, I think quite fascinating. Maybe true, maybe not, but an interesting way to end. And we may be here, we may not be here next week, because now it's time to sign off. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Robert Hansen, live from Hong Kong. Also to, in the second part, Dr. David Halpin from Devon. And I'll put links up to both of their stuff on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks obviously also to Martin Summers, you heard just then. And also to studio engineer and sound recordist Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and the longer interviews and contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, even though shadow banned. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. This show is repeated after this show and again 11 o'clock on Friday and 11 at 5 all week on the PRSC stream and over Sunday lunch in a couple of places from noon at richieallen.co.uk and Camberley's Radio QUK.com. Do please feel free to download and rebroadcast this show anywhere you like, but do credit me at thisweek.org.uk. My books I'll be sending out with the email this week, but you can get all of those published during the Halloween lockdown. Three of them, one about the end game of the Second World War, the relationship between Winston Churchill's private secretary, Desmond Morton, and Adolf Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, The Deal's Done, which absolutely shocking tale, really showing that the royal family was most definitely involved, particularly in this case, King George VI, with funding the bringing of the loot from the Second World War over to Britain, or the man who had the signatories. It was actually based in Switzerland, the money, but the signatory, Martin Bormann, was brought over to the UK by Desmond Morton, Ian Fleming, Bond novel fame, and John Ainsworth Davis, who died a couple of years ago. But anyway, that book is called The Traitors of Arnhem, and it also looks at the origins of the Bilderberg conferences. All three things, I suppose, Morton and Bormann and Bilderberg, all kind of one part of one plan, which was to use the Second World War for enormous changes in the world behind the scenes. So then there's also The Siege of Heaven and The Siege of Heaven Reader, and you can get all those either free downloads with a watermark, or you can buy them at www.bilderberg.org. So you can also request this show's reinstatement on FM. That's links to email BCFM chiefs that are on the contact tab at our show page this week.org.uk. So I may be having the week off next week, maybe actually in the air next Friday this time. So unless I'm on Wi-Fi, I won't be able to do the show, I'm afraid. But do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock, either next Friday or the Friday after. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Well, on a brighter note,
commercial break.
The government has now banned the carrying of spears.
Stop about every 1,000 miles, ain't asking too much, is it?
You might wish to stay on and listen.
It was a place where everything was legal.
I met this woman.
So if you're looking for emotional satisfaction, my advice to you is seek professional help.
Thank you for joining us live on the air.
My pleasure.
One Nation, under God, has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV, its satellite links are United States of unconsciousness. Apathetic, therapeutic, and extremely addictive. The methadone metronome, pumping out 150 channels 24 hours a day. You can flip through all of them, and still there's nothing worth watching. TV is a reason why less than 10% of our nation reads books daily. Why most people think Central America means Kansas. Socialism means un-American, and apartheid is a new headache remedy. Absorbed in its world, it's so hard to find us. It shapes our minds the most. Maybe the mother of our nation should remind us that we're sitting too close to the television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV is a stomping ground for political candidates, where bears in the woods are chased by Grecian formulated bald eagles. TV is mechanized politics, remote control over the masses, co-sponsored by environmentally safe gases. Watch for the PBS special. It's a perpetuation of the two-party system, where image takes precedence over wisdom, where soundbite politics are served to the fast food culture, where straight teeth in your mouth are more important than the words that come out of it. Race baiting is the way to get selected. Will he Horton or will he not get elected on television? The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.
On the screen is an address where you can mail your tithe offering or gift of love.
Okay, got the idea? All right, now let's concentrate.
We're living
for television.
TV, is it the reflector or the director? Does it imitate us or do we imitate it? Because a child watches 1,500 murders before he's 12 years old. And then we wonder why we've created a Jason generation that learns to laugh rather than abhor the horde. TV is a place where armchair generals and quarterbacks can experience firsthand the excitement of video warfare as the theme song is sung in the background. Sugar sweet sitcoms that leave us with a bad actor taste, while pop stars metamorphosize into soda pop stars. You saw the video, you heard the soundtrack. Well, now go buy the soft drink. Well, the only cola that I support would be a union COLA cost of living allowance on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. Back again, new and improved. We return to our irregularly programmed schedule, hidden cleverly between heavy-breasted beer and car commercials. CNN, ESPN, ABC, BCB, TNT, but mostly BS, where oxymoronic language like virtually spotless, fresh, frozen, light yet filling, and military intelligence have become standard. TV is a place where phrases are redefined, like recession to necessary downturn, crude oil on a beach to moose, civilian death to collateral damages, and being killed by your own army is now called friendly fire. TV is a place where the pursuit of happiness has become the pursuit of trivia, where toothpaste and cars have become sex objects, where imagination is sucked out of children by a cathode ray nipple. TV is the only wet nurse that would create a cripple. Television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance, feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.
Okay, got the idea?